Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and if I could, I would give you my best Clint Eastwood impression because this song is putting me in the mood. So for episode 96, let's get right into it. I had the pleasure of going to visit and hang out with one of Toronto's rising stars in the world of comic book creators, and he was a recent guest on the show as well in our indie comic book spotlight from Fan Expo. That's right, it's the co-creator of the Black Hole Hunters Club, the Quick on the Draw sheriff himself, Shane Herron. So in case you're wondering why I've chosen the Western theme for this episode, well, if you're listening, you probably already know. Shane has recently launched a Kickstarter for his book Morris, which is a post-apocalyptic Western story that pays tribute to the classic spaghetti Westerns that Shane is a huge fan of himself. So I wanted to set the mood right from the get-go with this episode. So please, there's still plenty of time. That the Kickstarter just started. Be sure to check out the Kickstarter yourself and throw a fistful of dollars his way to support it. Okay, a few dollars, in case a fistful of dollars sounds too daunting, but either way, support the book, because not only does it sound like a great, fun story to read, but Shane's one of the good dudes. We gotta support the good guys, right? So I just want to send a special shout out to Shane for hanging out with me for as long as he did, and being up for another 2-hour convo after we had just had one at the restaurant where we had a couple beers and some food. It was a blast, and that's one of the great things about being from Toronto, is that there's so many great artists and writers in our city that we can actually meet up with and hang out and be able to record these pods. So with that in mind, Ricky Lima, if you're listening, you're next, dude. So without further ado, episode 96 with Shane Herron. Enjoy the show, everybody. All right, let's get this show on the road. Tonight we have the pleasure of hanging out with local Toronto artist Shane Herron, the artist behind such books as Black Hole Hunters Club and the current Kickstarter that we're going to be expecting and anticipating, Morris. And we're going to be able to talk about these things this evening. It's been a pleasure to hang out with him tonight. Welcome to the show, Shane.
Hi.
We heard him recently on our Fan Expo interview. So I said that we were having plans of getting him on the show for an extended episode. So tonight we got that chance.
You weren't joking around.
I wasn't messing around. I'm trying to be serious about this thing now. There's too many times where in the past I'm like, I think I might get this guy on. I'm not sure. I don't want to say it. But now I say it and I make sure it happens.
Line him up and pull the trigger.
That's it. So what's going on, Shane?
Nothing. I feel like we have nothing else to talk about.
We've been talking. All our good content was at the pub tonight.
We went to the pub and had beers and food, and we talked for like 2 hours.
And yeah, it's like if we talk about it again, it's like, what's the point, right?
We'd have to like manufacture and try to remember what we said.
Yeah, it was. I should
mostly just shit talk DC. No, Marvel. Both. I don't care for either.
You're not gonna read any of them ever again.
That's not. I probably won't.
Nothing in continuity.
No, if it grabs my interest, I will. I think I'm kind of over it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get into that later.
Yeah.
Because I have some questions about superhero stuff that I wanted to ask you specifically.
Let's do it.
All right, so I'm going to do the Aaron Broverman approach.
Yeah.
I want to start from the come up. I want to ask you a little bit about the type of stuff that you grew up reading, enjoying, video games you played. Where did you grow up, first of all?
I grew up in Scarborough, Ontario, a suburb of Toronto.
And the high school you went to, want to shout it out?
Do I want to shout it out? Cedarbrae. In Cedarbrae, you used to go, Cedarbrae! I went to Cedarbrae High School, like Markham and Lawrence. Mm-hmm. I grew up in, kind of all over Scarborough. I grew up at the very early years at Kingston and Galloway, which is pretty ghetto. Like, we would... I remember me and my cousin, he lived on a separate floor, but we lived in this sort of really ghetto building. And we would, you run through the building playing tag and hide and seek and all that stuff. And we'd be like, we'd run by guys just shooting up in a stairwell. But
really?
But as kids, like, it didn't.
So shooting up, not shooting each other.
No. Like shooting heroin in a stairwell. Yeah. Ooh, but we'd run by them playing tag and it didn't do it. Like we never stopped and went, hey, what are those guys doing?
Wow.
And then you get older and you go, oh, those guys were just shooting up in the stairwell while we were playing
crazy.
Tag. Yeah, it was a pretty pretty ghetto place to be.
So it didn't faze you at the time. Did it faze you later when you realized like...
No, it didn't faze. We didn't really think about it. We were busy. You were kids, you know, you're playing tag. It's kind of that thing where when you're a kid, you don't really realize the world you're in. And then you get older and you go, that was kind of weird. That was kind of fucked up. Like,
right.
Yeah, there was a lot of colorful characters there.
So being in that area or where you grew up with the friends you had, what kind of stuff were you into other than playing tag around people who were shooting up?
Just playing tag. And you know, like... I don't know if I didn't realize, but as a kid, when you're in the playground, sometimes you just see a syringe.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just thought that was part of normal everyday life, but it's just where you lived in Scarborough.
That's where parents move away from.
Yeah, there's just like syringes and used condoms, and you don't think anything. You just go like, oh, don't touch that, right? When we were playing, we weren't playing in the sandbox with syringes. We were, I got really heavy into growing up, I was like, you know, the regular kid. I got into hockey cards and baseball cards, and then I was always really influenced by what my cousins were doing. My cousins who were a year older than me,
right?
They were always cooler. So whenever they were
always the case.
Yeah, they were into hockey cards. I was super into hockey cards.
Which did you collect? What set? Because I remember for me, my older cousins who are I think your age. We're into the scorecards. You remember that series where Eric Lindros was like, he had his own special...
Yeah, I didn't like those as much.
No.
We were into the... Let me see if I can remember them. I think Pro Set was like the cheapest brand you could get. So we got Pro... Because I was poor.
Yeah, I didn't
have a lot of money. So I think we had Pro Set and then we had the Opeaches.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there was the Upper Decks. Upper Decks were
like
high end. And they had those like hollow foil ones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I remember... They came out with Opeachy Premier.
Right.
And my cousins, who had more money than I did, they got a whole bunch of Opeachy Premier, and I could never afford the Opeachy Premier. They said regular Opeachy with the the gum inside, I think it came. Or there was like the below Pro Set, there was the Tops.
Right.
With the two P's, and they had like the old school style with like the stick of hard gum inside. You'd always chew it, but it was never good.
It just crumble in your mouth.
Yeah, it would crumble, yeah.
I remember my dad bought me the entire set of Pro Set 19, I think it was 1991, but you could buy like the whole box for like $5.
Yes.
And apparently every guy in there was their rookie season. Like as I'm flipping through it, everything was a rookie.
91 was a good year for rookie hockey.
It really was.
Yeah, that was. Is that the Yama Yager year?
Exactly.
Yeah, and like Roenick and all those
guys.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It was a really good year.
Yeah. Was Owen Nolan on that year, I think, too?
Probably.
Maybe.
Yeah,
somewhere around that time.
Yeah, yeah. No, that was a really good year. But it seemed like everybody had a rookie card. I was the type of kid who had the price guide for the hockey.
Oh yeah, cards, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I would put a price on each of them.
Yeah.
Cards.
What was the baseball and hockey one? Beckers? Is that what it's called?
Beckett.
That's right.
Price guide. Yeah.
Beckett price guide. And then you get into the comic books and you have the Wizard. Everyone bought Wizard price guide.
Did you buy Wizard or Hero? Do you remember Hero?
I remember Hero. I remember got a few Heroes, but I remember thinking, this isn't a Wizard. This is, you know, like, it wasn't the same.
This is the second tier.
Hero was, as far as price guides go, it might have been better. Because I know that, what do they have now still? Just the Overstreet price guide?
I think it's just Overstreet.
Which, as far as price guides go, but Wizard wasn't just about the price guide. You bought it for the price guide, but the articles were so good.
Yeah.
And then as the years went by, the price guide got smaller. And then it didn't exist anymore.
Yeah, I always wondered, like, I wasn't savvy to it, but, like, I enjoyed buying Wizard for the articles, and all of a sudden it wasn't an option anymore. Like, what happened? Was it just, do you think it was the online world that took
away? Well, I think that's part of it, but also what I saw was, because I loved Wizard. Like, look, I have all of my, these old Wizards, like, right here, look at these. Because they would get, like, look at that, J.G. Jones cover, there's a Joe Quesada, Ed McGuinness on Superman with, like, liquid coloring.
Why,
they get such good color covers. There, look, that is Batman and Superman, pencils by Jim Lee, painted by Alex Ross.
Yeah, that's great.
This is Joe Quesada, pencils, painted by Alex Ross.
Yeah.
Like, their covers were so good. But I think what happened was, I think that when the movie started coming out, they were all about, like, movie news.
Right. I used to love the
Wizard calls.
The casting calls, I remember some of the stuff that they'd come up with was so much better than what was in the movie.
Yeah, but it was also, like, unrealistic a lot
completely.
Of the time,
too. But I love the lists. Like, they would give you lists of, like, the best Fantastic Four you know, what if you're reading lists or,
oh yeah,
you know, best graphic novels in the last 25. I love that kind of stuff.
Everyone loves lists.
Yeah, I don't know what it was, but it was like even Rolling Stone magazine when they come out with the best like albums of.
Yeah. I love that. The 500 greatest albums of all time. Yeah. I might have some of those here too, actually.
Yeah, I buy all of those. 500
greatest songs of all time.
Yeah.
But that's a good way of learning about the past stuff that I got influenced and I'd read articles like. I would read, you know, an article with Rod Stewart, and talking about his influences, and then I would go back and be like, okay, now I have to find out who Otis Redding is, you know, right? Like as a young kid, you don't know that stuff, so
that's essential.
That is the cool thing about the list,
I miss that about Wizard. They would have like the best, the 100 best supervillains, and then on the flip side, they'd have like the worst supervillains you've ever seen. I love that stuff.
Yeah, and they always had the top 10 artists and top 10 writers every month.
I mean, that's a little skewed, but it's still fun.
But it was kind of cool, and it was also just cool to see a picture of the guy, because at that point you go, I don't know what Todd McFarlane looks like. I don't know what Eric Larson looks like.
Was there any guy that you saw on those lists like, oh man, that's what he looks like?
You know what the thing was Kevin Smith. I didn't know he was Silent Bob.
Really?
So when I saw he was writing Daredevil and I'd seen Mallrats and I saw the picture of him and I go, that guy looks like Silent Bob. That's so funny. And then I was like, oh, he plays Silent Bob in the movie. That makes sense.
It's so weird to me that the guy who, like, I feel can't shut up because he talks so much, plays a character named Silent Bob. Like,
I think he probably thinks that's pretty ironic and clever.
Yeah, I think so too.
Listen, I'm not going to spend another podcast shit talking Kevin Smith.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. Kevin Smith, this is the second time around. And what's that cover from?
That's a Steve McNiven Wolverine.
So did you pick the covers? Did you buy these Wizards based on the covers of
who's I bought Wizard every month.
Okay.
I think at one point, were they coming out more than once a month? I bought them all the time because I was so obsessed with Wizard. It got to the point in, I think, the late 90s and early 2000s where actually Wizard was a better... I got more excited about Wizard than the actual books coming out.
That's how I was with hip-hop. I used to collect The Source,
Wizards. Yeah.
I had about five... Me and my buddy had 5 years worth of the Source magazines.
Yeah.
From... He had it before me, but like from 99 until... 2004, I had every issue.
Yeah, and Source was a little bit bigger than a magazine, right? It was like kind of like Rolling Stone, where it was that a little bit larger size.
Because
I remember Double XL was your standard like magazine style.
Double XL and Source, I think, were the same size, but for a while, the Source had so much content in it. I guess maybe the advertisements were a lot, but it was exciting to get that magazine every month.
Yeah, I loved the Source too.
Yeah,
are those magazines still around at all? Are any magazines still around? Just like Rolling Stone, I think.
I think they are, but they might be bi-monthly.
Yeah, it's hard to have a print magazine. Some guy a couple years ago interviewed us, and he was trying to start a print magazine.
Really?
And I was like, in 2015, you're trying to start a print magazine? Like, are you insane? Like, Rolling Stone's like hemorrhaging money, probably. Like, you think you're gonna start a new print magazine that people want? Because
everything is, you got so much accessibility with these websites now.
Yeah, of course. You just start a Perez Hilton. That guy makes more money than a Source is making now.
Yeah, I haven't seen a recent copy of the Source. I don't know when the last time was.
Yeah, no, but I did love the Source too. Yeah. They had good like. Yeah, top 150 hip hop songs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's how I went back and learned a lot of stuff.
Yeah, me too. I loved looking forward to record reviews. At the time, not realizing how skewed
how many
they were.
Mics they got?
Oh, the mics, but even just realizing like, oh my goodness, like looking back, that guy paid for those rating. I didn't realize how skewed it could be.
Yeah.
But there was I did a lot of my hip hop homework. The original Source site wasn't great, but what they did have was all of the albums that had come out and were reviewed were in like a catalog where you can search and you could read every record review that they ever printed.
Oh, that's all right.
So that was a lot of fun to look up and see
their thing. If it was really good, you got five mics.
It was five mics. And then on top of that, they had a message board where everybody would put up like who was better, Bone Thugs or Wu-Tang.
Yeah, this guy
or that. And I used to just love reading everybody's comments because it kind of opened up your mind to what you didn't know about.
Yes.
I missed that. They've never done that again.
The thing about message boards is they're cool for that stuff, but you have to sift through like 5 million messages of people just calling each other like faggot and stuff. Oh, and you're like, horrible. What is like?
Yeah, that's the other part. And now you get on a message board to just comment on something that if I didn't really like this. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, don't even comment. Just get by your.
I made a huge mistake when Batman v Superman came out because I was anticipating it so much and I was very disappointed. So when I would talk to people about it, I got called some names that I was just like,
wow. Yeah, you can't win on
it. No, it was like, forget it. And it would bother me the whole day. I could easily be sucked into that world of like,
oh yeah,
forget it. No point.
Yeah, I love that. But like, you ever, one of my favorite things in the world is just YouTube comments. You scroll down. Because you get a bunch of people just saying horrible stuff to each other. But then you'll just get that one gem. And someone will just say something just completely off the wall. And you're like, yeah. I remember there was a whole thing about, it made me laugh so hard. It's probably so stupid. But when the whole Conan O'Brien, Jay Leno fallout happened. And okay. And all these people were arguing about who Conan's better. Oh, I'm a Letterman guy. I love Carson. And then just one guy, like, out of nowhere, you can tell he doesn't care at all. He just writes, like, all caps with exclamations. He's just like, Ed Sullivan for the win. Just, like, just stuff like that just makes my day.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. That one person just, I hate you all.
Yeah. It's like, you're all a bunch of idiots.
Yeah. Okay, let's get back to the Shane Herron show here.
Okay.
Before we get into Wizard and Source Magazine, because I can talk about that all day.
Yeah.
So, obviously, you are known, in especially in our city, as a comic creator, local comic creator. What got you into comics initially?
Again, it was the older cousins.
Older cousins? Like
they got after baseball cards and hockey cards, and then...
Was it the value of comics, or did they like comics? Because
it was all of it. It was that speculator era where their dads, everyone's dad had some fucking story. Where they had, I used to have Spider-Man number one. I used to have Hulk number one. And then all their parents threw them out, right?
Right.
And who knows? Like, my dad told me that. I'm like, he probably didn't fucking have anything. But who knows? Maybe he did have Hulk number one. They got thrown out. But that's, like, what, like, became the speculator era where everyone's dad had those comics. They threw them away. And the few people that hung on to them, they were worth a lot of money because they're rare. So then everybody started buying comics like crazy. It was it was kind of the Tim Burton Batman.
Right.
Where everyone all of a sudden was just back into comic books again and everyone was buying. And Image became such a big thing. And like guys were selling hundreds of thousands a month. Like the worst books were selling hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
And you get like millions per month, right? Like it's a big deal. So everyone was making a ton of money in these comic book world.
And those numbers are skewed when you look back because, for instance, X-Men number one from Jim Lee.
There's five covers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there's guys like myself who probably at that time would have been like, I should get all five covers.
And we did get all five covers.
Exactly.
So you know where you can get all five covers? In the quarter bin.
Exactly. you know what I mean?
If Superman number Death of Superman sells 6 million copies, it's not rare. It's not going to be worth anything.
Exactly.
But everyone doesn't put that math together and go,
no,
these are expensive because they're rare.
Yeah.
If I have one of 6 million copies, there's going to be no demand for it. And that's what happened.
I bought that Death of Superman. I had the graphic novel as a kid because that was the only thing I could afford to buy to read the whole story.
Yeah.
And I remember the poly bag was like, don't open it.
Yeah.
It's special.
It was $18 just for the poly bag.
Back then.
Yeah, and the trade was like $6 for the whole story.
Yeah. And I remember I was in Florida and I went to it was a guy who converted his house into a comic shop with long boxes. I found it in the dollar bin. In the poly bag.
Yeah.
Goes like, you know what I mean?
I asked for the Death of Superman for Christmas.
Well, yeah. The book? Like in the poly bag?
I didn't know what I was getting. I knew Superman was dying, and I was like, I need this. So my parents got me the whole thing, and so I still have the actual, from when I was a kid, the trade of Death of Superman.
Yeah.
And I remember reading that and being like, this is cool.
Yeah.
And he dies in it. So I didn't know, I was a kid, I didn't know what was in the poly bag, but I was like, what is in this poly bag? Like,
don't open it, it's going to be worth everything. Don't open it,
it's going to be worth so much money. So I opened it. And it was such a huge deal. And I read it, and I'm like, this is the end of the trade. It's the same story. Like, I didn't realize that as a kid.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, now I just waste all this money because I could have been rich with saving this poly bag. And then no one cared anyway.
No,
so
no.
And just... then remember when the Superman returns or Superman's alive?
Yeah, came out yeah, with yeah.
The poly white? Bag, the white poly bag.
That's worth even less.
Worth even less. Yeah, because there was like four different Supermen there. Like, they had those four different covers. I think I had five covers of that same book. It was nuts.
Yeah, it was Adventures of Superman 500. I remember I woke up one morning and I saw it beside my bed. It wasn't in a poly bag. It was just like the issue. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is amazing.
Yeah.
But at least at that time, there was a lot of cool characters created. Looking back, like you could say you got Cyborg, Superman, and Steel. And
oh, yeah, that. Absolutely.
Like, that's cool. But the value of those books are like...
But I feel like it's kind of we're returning to those same times where back then they were like, oh, Death of Superman sold a lot. Let's kill off Batman.
Yeah.
Break his back, whatever. Let's get rid of the Green Lantern. Let's get rid of the Flash. Like, yeah, they just followed that same because they were like, it's a big corporation. They want money. And they go, this is what sells. Killing off guys and replacing them. And then you get, with the Green Lantern? Kyle
Rayner?
Yeah, Kyle Rayner. And nobody wants him because nobody wanted to lose Hal Jordan. And everyone's like, screw this guy. There's a big backlash of it. But that's now they're kind of doing the same thing nowadays where they're like, oh, let's just make Thor a woman. That'll get female readers. And it's like, that's not exactly how it works, right?
I mean, thankfully, the Jason Aaron story is good. But we were kind of talking about this before. And I think for me, if I was coming back into comics and I wanted to buy an Avengers book, you look at that Avengers team and who on that team is an original Avenger.
Is there any? I don't read it anymore.
Well, you got the Falcon is Captain America. You've got the Jane Foster Thor. Iron Man was in that group for a little bit until he got replaced by Riri. I don't read that, but I know. And then you had the three young kids. It was Miles Morales, Spider-Man, Miss Marvel, and Nova.
Yeah.
But it's like, where is the thing that I'm... there's no familiarity.
Yeah, there's not even one anchoring point. Like, put the thing in there or something, you know?
Yeah. So it's one thing to change a character, but it's the same thing like you said. In the 90s, Wonder Woman was altered. Batman was the Azrael character. Superman, there was four different... It's like, where's the anchor?
Well, yeah, it's just like big corporations trying to figure out how to sell the most books without, like, they have no long-term plan. They just, like, everyone answers to a boss and they got to have these numbers, right? So that's the way it works right now. But
yeah,
it's like, I'm fine if you want to make Thor a woman, but I just feel like that's not the answer to getting female readers.
No.
What you end up doing is not bringing in probably a lot of female readers and then alienating the readers that you already have because they were like, well, I don't like this story. He's a woman now.
Yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know what they say. But, like, you got to come up with, like, what we were saying, like, the Miss Marvel. Create these new, cool characters that people can relate to. And you can kind of, you can't please everyone, but you can keep some of your hardcore fans happy and introduce new readers at the same time, right?
Yeah. And what's that thing that they call, like, when they, back in the day, like, when we were kids, you had the Jim Lee and the... who are the other artists at the time who used to really make those sexified shots of Psylocke and Mike Diodato's one?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It was just very... Is it a cheesecake shot or...
Yeah, I think a cheesecake shot.
Is that the term for it? Like, don't make that... Don't give Power Woman a window in her costume for cleavage
if you
want girls to read it.
Yeah,
right?
That's fair.
Like, I don't know if you read any Valiant books...
Comics, I've read some,
they're a really good, like, story, a company that has, a universe that's connected.
Yeah.
But they've got that character Faith.
Who yeah, that's right. She's, like, a heavier set girl.
It's just so much more relatable as far as, oh, she doesn't have her boobs out and she's not wearing a bathing suit for a costume.
Isn't she, though? Isn't she wearing, like, spandex or something?
She's wearing spandex, but it's not, like...
Yeah,
I remember
seeing that being
her.
Like, I'd like to check that out, see what's doing over with Faith. That looks pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really good. And it's one of those things where a lot of people can identify with the character, not because of she's a woman or sexuality or this, that, or the other. It's just more like, hey, she looks like one of us.
Yeah.
She kind of looks imperfect.
But it's hard to gauge that sometimes because you don't always, like, I don't know if, like, I'm sure Faith is good, and it does actually look interesting to me, but at the same time, it's like, I don't want Superman to look like me.
No.
I want Superman to look like Superman. Like exactly. The biggest bodybuilder in the world.
But that's Superman.
Yeah.
Right? That's what you expect from him. But yeah. Now if you're trying to attract newer people...
Yeah.
Right?
You I think it's kind of like the Terry Moore... That's my dog barking at the other dog in the building. She does this every time it goes up and down the stairs.
That's a good security system. My dog barks all the time on the show. It's good.
No, I like it in the sense that I feel like people will be scared to come in. Mm-hmm. But if they did, she'd just be like, hey.
You want to play?
Yeah, exactly. She wouldn't save me at all.
Yeah, same with me.
They literally could just murder me and she'd just be like licking their hand. Licking my blood off their hand as they stab me to death.
As long as the new person feeds them.
Yeah, exactly. She has no loyalty at all. She does not care. Those sounds, by the way, if you can hear them, is she's chewing on a bone. And she's laying on her bed upside down. She flipped it over.
Oh, she's being a good dog.
Yeah, I guess. It's all good. People are like, what's that crunching weird noise?
They're used, if they listen to this show, they're used to my That's dog fair, doing yeah. that. So it's all good. Okay, where were we?
I don't know.
I think we were just complaining about not being represented in comics.
Old white men complaining.
Yeah.
Oh, we're losing everything.
So... Your cousins were the ones who kind of got you into the comic books. You said you wanted Death of Superman for Christmas as like your present.
It was always the same way with my cousins. So I had on my mom's side and on my dad's side, I had a cousin who was about a year older than me.
Right.
And they were both just like the coolest guys.
Yeah.
And so whatever they were into, I was into. And it always worked the same where they were super into hockey cards. They were super into comic books. And then... I'd get so into it because of them and want to impress them. And then they'd eventually lose interest and move on to something else. I'd be like, hey, did you read the new Green Lantern? And they'd be like, man, that's for kids. What are you doing? Like, still reading comics? But comic books is one, like, I did hockey cards, baseball cards, because that's what they were doing. I've never actually been that into sports in general, like watching organized teams. I watched it because... they had a favorite team, so I felt like I had to choose a favorite team. You know, absolutely. And that type of thing. But the comic books, I was always a good artist. Okay. So that's something I didn't really fall away from very quickly, even after they lost interest.
When did you discover that you, one, had a passion to draw, but that you were actually pretty good at it?
I always tell people, people come to you at cons, and they always say, like, oh, how long have you been drawing?
Right.
And the answer I always say is that, well, we all used to draw.
Yeah, yeah.
In kindergarten was basically finger painting and drawing. Sure. Just most people stop drawing.
Yeah.
And it works with a lot of other things too, right? But I just didn't stop. Like, I just kept going with it. And I think it was just, I remember, maybe you're slightly better than other kids in school, but it's very, like, minuscule. I think it just depends on sort of the response you get. I remember really being interested in drawing, and I love drawing, like, animals and dinosaurs. And I remember my parents responding well, going like, he's a good artist. So they'd buy me markers and paper.
Right.
And they kind of were like, you're an artist. You know, like, and I don't know if I was necessarily better than anyone, but maybe their parents didn't respond in that same way.
They saw that in you. Your parents
responded. Yeah. And then I go in my head as a kid, I'm like, well, I like this attention. So I'm an artist. I draw. Okay. I'm very good at drawing. And then eventually you just keep drawing and you like never stop and try to get better, hopefully. I don't know.
Did that get passed on to you from like, are any of your parents got that sort of, I think you've got there's a talent that you can develop.
Yes.
To draw. And then there's also that gift that you just have the visual ability to draw better than another person. Did that come
I think from it's, a parent? It's, no, neither of my parents. Okay. In fact, I don't think anyone in my entire family is like artistic. Like, I have a huge like family on both sides, and I don't think any of them draw or do anything artistic like that. Actually, it's not. I think it is. My opinion is, I definitely it's nature over like or sorry nurture over nature.
Okay.
Like honing those. It's like anything. If you want to learn to play the guitar,
yeah.
You got to be Eddie Van Halen and not go to the party, sit on your bed and play guitar all night until you're that good at it, right? Like, it's just, it's practice, practice, practice. And Ty Templeton always says it too, because he teaches drawing, and he always says, it's like driving a car. You didn't know how to do it, and then you can learn to do it. It's the same idea. If you really do have the passion, you will do it. Right. But I think there needs to be some factors. I think some people are... just intuitively see things a bit better.
I think that
I think that definitely with it, yeah. Like, I think there is some people that they could put their heart and soul into it, exactly. And they just might never be. But I also think that there's people that are mediocre and they work harder than others.
And they get that.
I remember listening to, you know, Scott Hepburn.
Okay, yeah. Rage Studios.
Yeah, or... amazing artist. He's so good. And I remember listening to years ago, I heard a podcast interview with him, and he basically said that I wasn't the natural talented artist. Okay. But I put in the time and effort, and I had I just kept working at it. And I'm always sad when I hear that, because I feel like I was the opposite, where I feel like I did have some natural talent, and I would be the kid in class who was always kind of better than everyone else without trying hard.
Right.
And then I got into like my 20s and I didn't try at all.
Right.
And I feel like I could be a lot better.
It was something you could do naturally.
Yes. And I'm envious of that work ethic, whereas Hepburn's like, he's so good because he put in that time. And I'm like, maybe I could have been better, but I was fucking partying in my 20s. I was like, you know, I wanted to be a comic book artist when I was 11. I didn't make my first comic book till I was 25.
Yeah, I think that's personality type, though. Some people have that sort of focus of, like, they can be disciplined like that. And other people just...
Yeah, and I feel like I'm also one of the people, I feel like I try to get out of this headspace, but I always end up doing, like, the bare minimum. So if I can get by and do some, like, decent art without trying too hard, and people are like, oh, you're great. You're a great artist. It's not enough, though, right? You know, you actually have to put in the time and work harder, which I've been doing over the last few years.
Yeah. Have you seen that big change that, like, you may not see it as you go along, but when you look back at what you maybe did before to where what you can do now, do you see that either you're...
Oh, 100%.
Even faster?
I'll show you a book that you'll die laughing when you see. This is about 9 years ago. Look at this book. Awesome Marcus Ninja. That's my cover that I thought was so good at the time. It looks garbage. And then look at the interiors of it. Like, it's just so bad.
This was the first book you did?
No, it's one of the first, one of the earliest projects I worked on.
It doesn't look bad inside.
It's terrible. Like, I can't, I hate looking at it. I have a bunch of copies sitting there, and I'm torn between giving them away or just burning them because I don't know what to do with it.
You know, it's so funny nowadays that you, like... There's so many different interpretations of what people say. Oh, the art in something is great. And, you know, I think everyone, it's so subjective, right? And depending on what the content of the book is, affects people's perception of it. But I don't think it's...
Oh, it's terrible. This is terrible.
But we're always our own worst critic.
We should be.
We should be, yeah.
There's also, I know people that, I remember... Someone showed me a sketch they did. So from my very first con I ever did as an artist, 2007, someone came around and got a sketch from me, and they did like a jam piece of the Justice Society. Okay. I think I drew Hawkman. And then, you know, they had like, I think there's a few other artists there, did a bunch of different characters. And then someone showed it to me in the past couple of years, and I was like, I looked at it, and I was like, oh my Lord, that Hawkman is so bad, which is good. That means I got...
Better. Right.
But then there's another artist who I know today, and I see there, and I'm like, their art looks the same. It's like 10 years later, and they haven't gotten better. They haven't changed at all. And I'm always like, I feel like if you look back at your old stuff and you're super happy with it, there's something wrong.
Yeah. I think that's true. But then at some point, like, is John Byrne ever going to get better than what he did with the X-Men or Superman if you were to do something today? Like... He might.
John Byrne's kind of stuck in it. Like, it's a weird... I always think of John Byrne a lot when you talk about, like, dated things, because he draws now exactly like he drew in the 80s. But in the 80s, it was so good, and it looks so... Like, even when I look at his Man of Steel and stuff like that, it looks amazing.
Right.
But if you see him drawing that style in modern era with modern coloring, you're like, it looks weird and dated. Like, it just doesn't work.
You know what? Yeah.
He doesn't really evolve, I guess.
And I guess, too, like, some guys... There's some, like, I don't know if you look at any of Neil Adams' stuff that he's put out in the last couple years.
Not recent stuff.
It's Neil Adams, right? But I look at it and I'm just like, it's not the same.
Yeah.
You know?
Which is fair, because I mean, like, if we ever get to that age and we're still artists, we'll probably be
the
same mentality, right?
Like, his art still, it's still good. It's nothing wrong with it. But there's some guys who... I look at a guy like, I can't think of too many off the top of my head, but like Stuart Immonen.
Yeah, where he's like, evolved so much,
and he changes from one book to the next, where you can't sometimes even recognize
that. If you see his electric Superman stuff from the 90s,
yeah,
it's, you wouldn't guess it's even imminent at all. Yeah,
exactly. And then I don't know if you've ever read the Secret Identity book that he did with Kurt Busiek.
No, I didn't.
It's like an Elseworlds story.
Okay.
But it doesn't look like your typical Stuart Immonen art. It's just some guys have that ability to adjust how they draw certain stuff, and you don't recognize it necessarily. But for the most part, you know when it's a George Perez or
absolutely
a John Byrne, right?
But I think maybe guys, if I had to guess, I would say maybe it's because Perez and John Byrne and guys like that, they had such success back then.
Yeah.
So maybe in their mind, they're like, why would I change? Like, this is what the people want.
Right.
I changed the game. Why would I change? Whereas, say, like, Stuart Immonen, he didn't really blow up until the 2000s when he started working on the X-Men and stuff like that. Like, people saw his electric Superman stuff, and no one was really, like, blown away by it. So maybe it's, like, maybe you kind of get stuck in that era where you have the most success. Who knows?
Yeah.
But maybe guys are just constantly evolving.
Yeah.
Like, Will Eisner, he evolved until the day he died, right?
Yeah.
Like, he just kept working, making comics his life.
Who did you have as, looking back, now that you're mentioning artists' names, did you have a preference? Was there a guy that you particularly were drawn towards? Like, okay, John Byrne or George Perez, who did you prefer? It's a tough one.
That is a tough one. It's a little bit, like, out of... It wasn't really my era. Like,
right.
I feel like I just missed that era.
Yeah.
Whereas I would say, personally, John Byrne. Like, I always picture... I mean, he did a million great things, but his Man of Steel series, like, that miniseries he did, like, that's Superman to me.
Yeah, me too.
And then George Perez, I remember, I didn't really know about him until later on when he was doing the Avengers series in the late 90s with Busiek.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember just thinking, like, why does everyone love this guy so much? I don't get it. And then one day I just got it. And I was like, he's such a good storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
I think I didn't like the way he drew certain characters. Like, his Thor had a kind of rounded nose and looked kind of like a dork. And, you know, just little things like that
where I was like,
no, he doesn't draw a cool Thor, so he's not my guy.
Right.
And then you see the, like, Crisis on Infinite Earths poster that he penciled and Alex Ross painted. And there's, like, every single DC character of all time on there. And you're like, okay, I get it. Like, I get what he does. And then you see guys like Phil Jimenez, who was basically trying to be George Perez.
Right.
He was kind of like a more modern George Perez. And you're like, you kind of, it sinks in a bit more. So I think in the long term, I would go, like, if I had to choose one to read their books for the rest of my life, I'd probably read a George Perez book over a Byrne.
Really? Okay, cool.
But I mean, in my mind, I'm like, John Byrne's so good, right? Like, he's the guy.
Yeah, it's that thing of, like, they were each other's, not rival. I'm sure they weren't, like, direct rivals.
I never actually even, like, compared the two of them until you said that, so that's interesting.
But like,
it makes sense that they're very compared.
You know, Teen Titans, the other was X-Men. And
that's
then you
right.
had Marv Wolfman and Chris Claremont.
Yeah.
And they were kind of like, I hate to make that comparison, but they're kind of like the Jay-Z and Nas of their time, of, like, they're both great at what they do, and they're very...
Well, you just compare everything to Jay-Z and Nas.
I do. I compare everything to that. But it's kind of like those two people that everyone kind of takes aside, and neither answer is wrong.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like, where were you in that timeline of stuff?
That's why I love the Ninja Turtles, because it's just like a parody of everything that was going on in that, like,
right?
The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
I didn't realize that until they did. I saw the documentary, and you're like, this was just a parody of, like...
Or like a satire, was it even? Like, yeah, I guess.
Like Daredevil?
They were just make fun of, like, Frank Miller's Dare Ninjas, and then make fun of the mutants, make fun of the teenagers, and then we'll just make them turtles. And everyone loved it, and they became millionaires. It's amazing.
Did you watch it as a kid?
Yeah, I loved it.
I loved it too.
I remember in grade 2, I think. That's where I was. I remember distinctly this memory of me and my brother fighting over the remote control and flipping and flipping, and you know, you do that as a kid, and then hitting a channel, and we were like, what is this? And I didn't notice the shells, you know, you're a little kid, and I was like, these guys are frogs, look at these frogs. And then he's like, no, there's turtles, you idiot, like, there's shells. And then we both just stopped fighting and just watched Ninja Turtles.
That was a great
and
show.
I just became obsessed with it.
Did you know Chuck Lorre wrote the theme song to that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, that was his theme song. I was
someone
shocked.
Taught me how to play it on the. Remember when you used to talk on the phone in high school and you could be like 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 1 2 and it's like 3 6 3 6.
I did not know that.
Something like that.
Who did you end up calling?
Or no, just go no, to it doesn't call him. It's just like if you're like, you know, you're in a high school and you're talking to a girl, or whatever, and you like you just sit on the phone because so you did back in the day, and you could just. I don't know. One of the girls was like, she was like a music student. She was like the tones of it, and she was So I think it was like 1 2 1 2 1 1 1 2 3 6 something like that.
That's hilarious.
Played Ninja. I didn't know Chuck Lorre did that. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I was shocked.
He probably was just a millionaire just off of that then.
Yeah, it was. You know when I noticed it? I mean, I'm kind of embarrassed to say, but I went to actually watch the sequel to the new Ninja Turtles movie.
Yeah.
That had come out recently, and they played that song at the beginning and at the end, and they showed the credit like written by Chuck Lorre. And I was like, no way. That like from way back then, that guy was getting paid off of.
Yeah.
This syndication, that's ridiculous. Yeah, tangents. I love the tangents.
They're love great. Tangents. Do you want to hear my Morris theme?
Yeah.
I got my friend Steve Cruikshank to write a theme for Morris for me.
I heard about the Morris theme when I was listening to your episode with Jay Clark.
Oh, yeah. I'll just play it.
This is exclusive.
This is, I think this is exclusive.
Sweet.
It's, let me find it here. He sent me, he did two versions. One was like, I thought it was too pleasant.
Maybe if you send the file to me, we can open the show with the Morris theme.
Yeah, okay. So should I not play it now?
Can play it now. Why not?
So I really wanted a sort of like a spaghetti western type thing.
Right.
Morris theme to... No, this is not it. Is this the right one? Okay, this is it. Stop making noise, dog. I'm gonna turn it up. Isn't that cool?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What inspired you to want to have a theme song for, like, how are you going to incorporate it?
Well, I was going to do like a Kickstarter video.
Right.
And, I have a Kickstarter video, and then I was just going to look at, because you can't just play like licensed music.
No,
right?
Yeah.
Because I had a few ideas where I was like, I'll just play that. And I was like, you can't do it. So. Ricky and I were talking because he sent me a bunch of links to like royalty free music, that was called. I don't know, like public music you can use. And then I was like, I know a guy who's a talented musician, and he might be into it. He's kind of like this guy that's a genius musician, and you can't harness him, so you can't do it. Like, so he did this for me, actually. He did two versions. One was like, it was really good, but it was just too nice. I want like darker. I want some whistles. I want some like, I think the guy who did all the like the Fistful of Dollars and Good the Bad, I think his name is Ennio Morricone.
Yeah.
And he did like a lot of those spaghetti westerns. So I wanted something in that kind of world, and that's what he came up with, and I love it.
That's
so
awesome.
I was like, I'll use it for my Kickstarter video. And then, who knows, if Morris ever becomes a cartoon, maybe that will be the opening theme. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Whatever. That's a great idea. I didn't even, like, it's cool that you're thinking further in advance for the character. Like, we're all kind of waiting for the comic book to come out, but you're like, this could
be... Yeah, I mean, like, I'm not planning what to do with it. I'm just hoping someone scoops it up like Ninja Turtles and they go, this can be something bigger.
Yeah, but it's good that you're already planning, like, let's make a theme song for him. Like, you're creating a whole...
Yeah, well, I also thought it'd just be fun. And he was into the idea, and I was like, let's do it. And he did all the work.
So... Before we get into talking about the Kickstarter, because I really want to get into Morris, because I'm getting excited for it, seeing all of the different art that people are, the pinups that people are doing for it. So when did you finally decide that you were going to make comics as a definite goal? Like, I know you've done the Black Hole Hunters. You've talked about that a lot. But when was that decision for you to be like, okay, I got to make this comic? You
said you're 25. This is the dumb thing. So in grade five, me and my buddy were just so obsessed with comic books that we got the entire class into comic books. Everyone was like, Death of Superman, X-Men cartoon was happening. And we were just obsessed. And the teacher made one of our final projects, a comic book, because... Like, she was just like, I can't fight this anymore. You guys are just too obsessed with these books. And I remember when I was 11, I'm thinking, I'm going to be a comic book artist. This is what I'm going to do. And then I didn't make a comic book until I was 25. Like, I made that one in grade five. And then I just, right. I had all these ideas. And I would draw. And I went to art school. And I was always, like, pretty talented, naturally artist. Didn't really try too hard.
Where did you go to art school?
Well, I took, like, in my high school, we had an advanced art program. So okay. I took all those classes. And then I ended up going to, I just took Centennial, okay. Their art fundamentals program. And then I just decided that I don't like school. Mm-hmm. So I stopped doing it. And then I realized that you could just make your own comics or just art in general. Go to cons, go to where there's other good artists, show them your work. And a lot of them will give you really, really good, solid feedback if you're willing to take it. And that's more than any art school you could ever get. Like, you go to art school and, I don't know, most of the teachers I've had growing up, they're just, like, failed artists.
That's what Mike Ruth was telling us. Like, it was guys that were just upset.
They're bitter. It's literally those who can't do teach.
Right.
And art school, it's so true. Like, what is she doing? Sorry, the dog's just whipping all the cushions off the couch. That's her new thing that she's discussed. I love when they just all of a sudden have a new behavior. And you're like, what is there to this guy? Now she throws the cushions off the couch. Or her ball's stuck under the couch. Too bad. Most of the art... The only real good art teachers I had growing up were ones that had themselves had success in the art world. They weren't just bitter that they never made it, so they started teaching.
Right.
A lot of them are very close-minded. They don't really want you to expand and be... You know, it's not math where that's the answer.
Right.
It's art. Let people express and have some fun. And you're going to have 30 kids. Yeah, you have 30 kids that follow all these guidelines. And at the end of the project, you got 30 things that kind of look the same.
Right.
You know what I mean? Where I was just like, I was always like kind of a rule breaker and like push authority. And they hated it that I would try to.
Go against the grain?
I wasn't doing it because I was an artist, but I would just try to like just break the rules. But that's part of art too, right? It's like pushing the boundaries.
Yeah.
Give me a box and let me draw outside the box. And they don't want that, right? So I've always kind of been like that in general. But I remember working for a few years and just partying and having fun in my 20s. And then I had a comic book plan that I was going to do. This character I would just draw. And these other people would always be like, you should do this comic book. And I kept being like, yeah, I will. I'm going to do this comic book. And I just never did because... It's hard to sit down and make yourself work when you're having a lot of fun.
Right.
And then when I was about 25, I had a couple people who just, they were kind of artists in their own field. And they just sat me down and were like, you need to make comic books. You need to make this comic book. And so I booked a show at Paradise 2007. And I was behind the table all of a sudden, instead of just being a fan at like Fan Expo and stuff, I was at a con and I had a table, and now I had to have something to sell at the table, so I started making my own books.
Right.
And that's like literally 10 years ago was my first books, and they're terrible, terrible.
But it got the ball rolling.
100%, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like anything that you have a skill for when you first do it, that first version, it's not going to be the best thing you ever... It's always going to be the worst, right?
Well, that's part of the thing is I was kind of like... I suffered from this, and a lot of guys that come to cons and want to get portfolio reviews and stuff like that, it's the same kind of thing where they have this idea, but they're not ready for it yet. And they have this great idea, and they're waiting till they're a better artist. And I'm like, just do it.
Yeah.
You
can always refine it.
Yeah. Also, you better have a lot more than one fucking idea. Because if you don't, you're not going to make it anyways, right? Like,
right.
This is not, like, there's no perfect time. Now is the time. Start making it.
Right.
I'm not going to lie to you. The beginning stuff is not going to look great unless you're a real, like, savant or something like that.
Yeah.
You're going to make a lot of mistakes and you're going to hate looking at it.
but you're doing it and you're going to start learning. And then you show people and you get feedback and you learn. And that's how you become a better artist. So I'd like to think I'm a lot better of an artist from 10 years ago, right? Like,
but when you made that book, this was the first one you said you did?
No, this one was, they were actually little, because I remember I read A Wizard and there was a Jim Mahfood, How to Make Your Own Zine.
Okay.
And I remember the idea of making a comic book, buying 11 by 17 pages, drawing, penciling, inking. You know, I always thought like the old school guys. Scanning it? I didn't know how to scan anything. Like putting into a book? I didn't know how to do any of that, but it seemed so daunting, right? I was right. Like, I know how to draw, but I don't know how to make a comic book. Do I have to hire a writer? Do I need an editor? Like... But I remember seeing that Jim Mahfood thing and he was like, how to make your own zine. And I just thought, well, I can do that. I can buy 8.5 by 11 paper, fold it in half, and those are my sheets. And then all I basically have to do is figure out which page goes where to tell the story.
Right.
So my first comic books were, I went to like, I guess, business Staples, and I photocopied those pages. I figured out in Photoshop how to lay out the pages so that, you know, I'd do my own little like dummy papers where I'd like figure it out and go, okay, put page one here, one this. So I made my own books were just like hand photocopied black and white books that me and my girlfriend at the time were just stapling, and I went to shows with like these little books. And it was this book called The Almighty. And it was this little weird hairy guy, and he would just go around fighting different champions and taking talismans from them. Because I wasn't a good writer, or I always thought of myself, not even as an artist, as a penciler. That was my goal. Like, I'm going to be a penciler. Like Joe Madureira or J. Scott Campbell, right? So I never tried to learn how to ink. I was like, well, I don't need to learn that because eventually I'll be a penciler.
Right.
And they will hire me an inker. And then I eventually learned, like, I got an ink brush. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, I can actually learn to do all these skills. And
right.
I actually fell in love with an ink brush and learned to do that. But I remember thinking, I'm not going to write. I'm not going to try hard at writing these stories. I'm not a writer. I'm a penciler. Eventually, I'll do this, and someone will write it for me, and then someone will ink it for me, and someone will color it for me. So I just did these like really crude comics, roughly inked, of this guy beating up other guys, basically. I just did 2 issues, and then I met Joel Buxton, who was working on Marcus Ninja with another artist. I met him at that first Paradise show, and his artist didn't want to do it anymore. So he contacted me and said, do you want to keep doing Marcus Ninja with me? So I started doing that. It was a web comic that we did for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then, we collect them into like books and stuff like that, basically.
But when you saw that at the time, did you look at them the way you look at it now? Or were you like, this is amazing. I can't believe I did this.
Oh yeah. When I first did this cover looks so garbage to me right now, but I remember doing it and looking at it and I was like, I'm very pleased with myself.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you should be happy with it at a time. I mean, it's hard to, I think a lot of artists, and I suffer from it too, but it's hard to be happy with anything you do.
Yeah.
I look at a lot, like I do con sketches, and Ricky will tell you this, I hate drawing at cons. I'm terrible at it. I feel like whenever I do a sketch for somebody or commission, I feel bad taking their money and giving it to them because I feel like I did a terrible job, even though they're like, this is great, I love it. And in my head, I'm like, I could have done way better.
Well, you did a pretty great sketch in my book, I have to say.
I think that was one that I was happy with.
That was really good. Hellboy. And you're probably the most affordable person you could get a sketch from at a con.
What did I charge, $20 for that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was doing smaller ones for $20, but then you had that book with all the cool drawings. And then there was that Thor by Mike Ruth, and I remember being like, well, I can't just do a little throw. Like, I can't just go, it's $20, I'll do a little quick one. I was like, I gotta go big.
You went in, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it was good.
Yeah, that's good. Because I was looking at, when I was researching more stuff, I was looking back for old art stuff, and I came across a Hellboy I drew at a con. And I'm like, whoa, it's so bad. Like, I didn't know how to draw his right-handed Doom, so it's kind of just trailing off the page. Like, it's just so bad.
You took some shortcuts.
Yeah, and then it's the thing where you think, like, no one will notice, you know?
Yeah.
I'll trick everybody. I don't know, draw hands? Everyone's got their hands in their pocket in this comic book. You know, like,
that type of thing. Is there still that thing today that you have a hard time drawing or that you kind of, like, do shortcuts for?
Yes,
and it's the same result where I'm not fooling anybody. I struggle with perspective. I hate rulers and stuff like that. So I try to laze my way out of it. And every time I do a lazy job, it shows the final product.
Yeah.
Like I think on the new Morse cover that I did, I think like I did it properly with rulers and vanishing points. And I think it turned out pretty good. Thank you.
Yeah.
And then there's things like I've never been really good at drawing women. I'm never really comfortable drawing women. Sometimes I do a good job. Often I feel like they look too manly. Because I grew up with this mentality. It's also like the Scar War mentality where, I don't know, it was weird where I felt like if, you know, like Scar War, especially when I was a kid, like very homophobic and stuff. Everyone would call you a fag if you did something feminine or whatever. So I remember always not wanting to draw women because I felt like, I don't know, that was too feminine for me to draw. And they'd be like, why are you drawing a girl or something?
Yeah. Or you like drawing girls.
Yeah, which I did. I would just draw big, muscly men, which is even more homosexual. Like, I just spent my whole childhood drawing big, muscular guys. But I felt like I wouldn't be embarrassed showing someone a drawing of a muscular Hulk.
So weird.
Whereas I didn't want my mom to see me drawing boobs on a woman. You know what I mean? Like, there's a weird thing where...
Yeah.
Like, I felt like they would think I'm a pervert or something. I don't know. So I was never really comfortable drawing women, so I'm still never truly comfortable. I still feel like I do it well sometimes, but I feel like I struggle with drawing women very feminine and sexy, whereas I feel like a lot of them just look like they have like a manly jaw or like, you know, something like that. So I think I'm getting better at it, but it's definitely something I'm aware of, and I want to be more like fluid and natural at it. And I see guys like Frank Cho and their stuff's like, it's just so like feminine and sexy and but at the same time,
he goes a little too far.
Well, like here's the cover for. I don't think he goes too far. I think he's.
Wasn't it him with the Spider Woman? The whole.
Yeah, he's making fun of people who were upset about the Milo Manara cover of the. Okay. Was it Spider Woman? I think. But that's him. Yeah, he's going too far, but he's trying to make a point. He's trying to say like, we're artists, and this is what we do. Sorry, I gotta take this ball away from her.
It's a driver's mental. She found another ball to play with.
Yeah, Chris and I have to hide this one from her because it sounds like a dead seagull. I don't mind it, but I certainly don't want it on a podcast. Go get your other ball. And she looks at me like, where is it? Magic. Go get your other ball. You got a million other balls. Yeah, I think Frank Cho is making a good point. I think he is, from what I've seen, I think he's a little bit perverted.
Yeah.
I think he hides behind art. In a sense, whereas, you know, I see someone like Paul Pope who draws like spreads of women's vaginas and stuff. But at the same time, I look at it and I go like, this is art. Like he is art. He's not hiding behind it. He's truly like an artist. Whereas I think Frank Cho is one of the greatest artists I've ever seen in my life. But I feel like there's a weird, he's the kind of guy that goes to life drawing to see a naked lady, not to become a better artist. You know what I mean?
Got it.
That type of, like, you get that vibe from him and that type of thing. But don't get me wrong, I love his work. But I just, you know what I mean?
That's so funny. I'm going to look in Morris now and see all the women who look like men.
Oh, no. So this is, but this kind of works. This is cover for issue 0 of Morris, and it features the female character, Hannah. But she's like lives on kind of the boundaries of the town. She's a cowgirl. She lives solitary a lot of time. So I wanted her to kind of, it's a weird instinctual thing where I've always been trying to make my woman more feminine.
Yeah.
Now I want her to look like a bit more like a fella. Like she doesn't put on makeup. Yeah, she has a bit of a scar on her chin. Like she doesn't fix her hair, that type of thing. And she can stand, you know, in a more masculine pose. So it's like
you definitely know it's a woman, but it's not over sexualized.
That's what I was hoping. Because I remember as a kid drawing women, and people were like, "It just looks like a guy with long hair." And I would try to get better at it. So this goes against my instincts, where I want her to look a bit more. I don't want her to be a feminine woman, but I want you to look and go like, "Okay, that's a woman,"
right?
But she's a cowboy, you know, like.
Got it.
So I feel like I did a good job with that cover.
No, it looks good.
But that is something I struggle with a lot.
And I will say that looking at this comparison to the first cover, you've improved.
Thanks. Yeah. That's the idea. Yeah.
So tell me about Morris, because now we're getting closer to the Kickstarter and everything coming together. I've heard it in other podcasts, the idea, but now we're like almost at the cusp of it.
I hopefully, like, I don't know when this episode will go out, but I'd like to think this will be, it'll be up and running by then. Mm-hmm. I've had, like, some setbacks that I was telling you about earlier where it's just really slow to come together, but now I think everything's in place. So hopefully if you're listening to this now, go check out Kickstarter. Just look up Morris by Shane Herron.
So when do you think the Kickstarter will be out?
I'd like to do it Monday. Today's Thursday.
Okay.
Because I've read a bunch of stuff online, too, where they said that don't do it on a weekend. That's brutal. And don't do it on a Friday because people are just at work and they're distracted. They want to go and have beers.
Right.
They don't want to look online and buy on a Kickstarter. And I guess Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday is like a better day to do it or whatever. You'd think maybe Friday would be good because, like, oh, people are getting paid. Maybe they'll want to, like, spend some money. But apparently, so I'm not going to do it Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. So hopefully it's like Monday or Tuesday this week. But mm-hmm. by the time this is up, hopefully it's up there.
Up and running. Kickstarter. And how long do you plan to have the Kickstarter going for?
30 days.
Okay.
Yeah. There's ones you can do now where you can set it for like 60 days, but they I've researched a lot because I've never done a Kickstarter before. And I constantly text Ricky all day long because he's done 3 successful Kickstarters now. But yeah, I just researched and a lot of them, they say like do it on like a Monday or don't do it on a weekend or I don't know.
So what are the details then about starting your own Kickstarter? Because I always hear about people, I got a Kickstarter going.
Yeah, everyone has a Kickstarter. Everybody's got a
Kickstarter, right? What's worth checking out? What's worth supporting? So tell me what the process was like for you, your first time doing this. What motivated you to want to put this through a Kickstarter?
I've said this a few times on other shows too, is that when Kickstarter first came out, I didn't like it. I thought of it kind of in the same way I think of Patreon now, where I thought it was like, I feel like you're just asking people to give you money.
Yeah.
You're not, like, sure, you're giving something, but I felt like in my head it was like you're looking for a handout.
Yeah.
And I kind of changed my tune, not just because I've seen, like, I remember, remember the Hope Nicholson and Rachel Ritchie did the Nelvana?
Okay, yeah.
And I remember, so that was like when Kickstarter first came to Canada. And Rachel was working at the Comic Book Lounge where we were hanging out a lot. And she was telling me about this Nelvana, which I'd never heard of. And I was like, nobody's going to care about this Nelvana shit. You're going to do a Kickstarter, like, no one's going to care. And then they made, like, 60 grand. It blew up.
Right? You never know.
And so I had to eat some humble pie, and I was like, I still don't care about Nelvana, but I was wrong. People really care about this stuff. So I don't think it's like necessarily like I think people just see like other people make big money out of Kickstarter and they go, well, it's easy money. Just put it together. And then you see some pretty brutal ones. My thing was that, and it's not just Ricky. A lot of people, they basically convinced me that it's just a really good way to hype your stuff.
Right.
Because I could print 100 books and go just sell them at cons. But that's like it's hard to sell 100 books at cons. But if you do a successful Kickstarter, you could maybe sell 200-300 books a lot easier. Right. And you get people, like, there's different types of audiences. Again, I've not done a successful one. I'm just researching this. But basically, you hit up, there's audiences like your fan base. I have a small fan base, like Ricky and I do with Black Hole Hunters. And then there's, you know, friends and family that want to support you. And then there's people that just go on Kickstarter and they want to check out what's new and support projects. That's just like a cool thing to do. And so you get those three together and hopefully you can put together a good Kickstarter. And you can sell it to anyone in the world, basically, if that's what you want. Like, you can set it. But, like, a guy in Finland can buy my book, whereas even if I'm in Diamond, it's a lot. I can't sell to that guy in Finland very easily, right?
So true.
That's the idea behind it. Because originally my plan was, like, I'm not going to do a Kickstarter. I'll just pay for an original print run. I'll print 100, sell them, use that money to pay it forward, and do a bigger print run.
Right.
And then I just thought, you know what? Let's try it out. Let's do the Kickstarter. And I feel like the problem is now I feel like I've put all my eggs in one basket. So I think it will be good, but also I'm excited and nervous at the same time.
But that's part of the fun of it, right? That excitement, that nervous, like that's.
I feel like I won't find it very fun if I fail and I have a shitty Kickstarter. People laugh at me.
But it's part of the motivation too, right?
Yes.
To know that I gotta have something to show for now. I can't just have
this. Yes.
Idea in my head of what I'm working on this book.
Yeah.
Now you're really like, I'm putting it out there and it may sink or it may sail.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it makes you put your all into it.
That's one thing people talk bad about the internet for a lot of different reasons, and it's terrible, the internet. But the one thing I do love about it is the democracy. Mm-hmm. If you put out a Kickstarter, if it's good, it should go, right? Like, unless you do everything wrong. If you have something worthy, I feel like it will be, people will enjoy it. And if it's garbage, I feel like people very quickly don't pull punches online, and they won't support it, or they'll call you out for being shitty or whatever. So,
right.
I feel like I'm doing all the right stuff so far. I mean, I got a lot of people involved doing pinups.
Yeah.
I feel like I got a good amount of hype going right now, where I get multiple messages a day, people going like, when's this coming? Like, I want to buy this book.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's a good sign, right? So I've been working on this for, like, that right there, that's the original first ever Morris drawing.
Oh.
I did that in 2011.
Wow.
And it was just like, I was having an art jam with friends here, and I did it, and people were like, that's cool, I like that. And then everyone who I showed it to kind of really liked the look of the character. I mean, he's like, he kind of looks like the Monopoly Man or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I printed, I did
some. Is that what you based it on?
No, I was just doodling. I just wanted to draw a fat guy with a mustache.
Okay.
And then it was like a cowboy. And then I did some prints of it because people really liked the idea. And I sold the prints and people were really liking it. And then so the other drawings you see, it was just going to be a series of illustrations featuring this fat mustached cowboy guy.
Got it.
And then I got to a point where I was out of work in 2012. And I wasn't sure what to do. I was kind of in between jobs. And I remember being like, Morris is going to be my next thing.
How did you come up with the name? Like, you had the image, and then Morris doesn't seem like a cowboy.
You know where I came up with it? It's actually pretty funny. I don't think I've ever told anyone this. It's just been in the back of my head. Remember I told you that building where I grew up, where it was like really ghetto and people had heroin? Everyone in that building, it was like Kingston Road and Galloway in Scarborough. So if you know the area, it's bad. Like, it's just really ghetto. And we were just like poor kids playing around the playground. And in this building, it was like a lot of people just like on welfare and that type of stuff. And just like, these people are like monsters that lived in this building. But there was one guy, he was the superintendent, and he took care of everyone, and his name was Morris, and he had a mustache. He wasn't like old, like the way Morris is drawn.
Yeah, yeah. But
he was like I was a kid. He was probably 30, 40, 50. He's an old man to you, right?
But he left an impression.
He was, because he was such a fucking sweetheart. And I remember he had a mustache, but he had dark brown hair, dark brown mustache. But in like this world of horrible people, he was like this lovely, nice man that took care of everyone. And like, if there was, a mess, he cleaned it up. There was something. And then I don't know what happened to him, but the rumor was, I don't know if it's true, but someone always told me that he won the lottery.
No way.
And that's why he didn't do that anymore. And I don't know if it's true, but I'm like, I'd like to think that's true because he was such a sweet guy. So that's like, when I drew the mustache guy, I just kind of like, it just came to me, and I went like, Morris, like kind of Morris. So it's based after that guy, really.
So if he's out there listening, that's pretty, that's
like, he's a nice probably really old, man. Because I was probably like 6, and he was, I don't know, 50?
He's still alive.
Yeah.
That's pretty, that's nice. I like that.
I think so, yeah. I just realized, like, that's the first time I told anyone that. That's where the name came from, yeah.
That's so cool. So give us the premise of what Morris is, because you've talked about it on other podcasts before. But now that the Kickstarter is about to happen, people want to back it. What is it that we're going to be buying into for this character?
So what I have for the Kickstarter is 3 books. The main book is Morris Issue 1.
Okay.
It's a 24-page book, full color, written and drawn by me. And it introduces you to this world that Morris lives in. And that world is, it's a post-apocalyptic world. And there's this weird kind of, it's just a Western town. It seems very Western-y, but it's post-apocalyptic. And this is a safe kind of oasis where people still live in a normal society where they contribute. And outside of it is just anarchy and chaos and all kinds of different stuff. But the town's kept safe by Morris, who's the sheriff. He's just this big, fat, mustache, badass guy. And, yeah, he keeps everyone safe. He has a bunch of different... Should I...
No. I just think it's so cute that she's trying to get her ball.
It's under the couch. I can always go grab it quick if the noise is making too much.
No, that's fine.
I think it's hilarious. I think she does this, like, when I go to work, she just does this for, like, hours.
I love watching how they just don't understand how things work. You like just keep clawing at the couch as if the ball's gonna appear.
That's adorable.
Yeah.
Wow.
Anyways, yeah, so Morris protects the town of Beatrice, that's what it's called. And he has got a bunch of different deputies that kind of, they watch the borders of the area and report for trouble and stuff like that. So in the first issue, you're introduced to Morris, and he has a kind of a sidekick, this kid Tread. And that kid is, he watches the swamp area, the swamp border. It's kind of like this kid wants to work for Morris and be a deputy, but he's a little too young. So Morris kind of gave him, he's like, you can watch over the swamp area because there's not, nothing ever happens there. And so in the first issue, these Komodo boys, these big lizard, anthropomorphic lizard guys show up and cause trouble, and they come through the swamp with Tread. So it's like that's, so basically Tread comes to report, and then they have to go deal with the situation with these Komodo boys. And that's the first issue. And then the issue zero is, it's actually a story I came up with when I first got my dog, because I just got her in March, and we go on these like walks. Mm-hmm. You know, here's a dog, you go for walks. And we go through, there's a big park near my house, and there's all these ravines that we go through. And so you're just like, she's just sniffing at whatever, and I'm just thinking about story ideas and whatnot. And so I came up with the idea for the Morris issue zero, and all the imagery is kind of reference images I've taken on our walks and stuff like that of different areas. But basically, Morris has to show up at one of the border posts, I guess you'd call it. And there's this girl, Hannah, who's one of his deputies who watches the borders. And there's basically been a guy who's been exiled from the town. He didn't, you know, he broke the rules and he had to go. And so she calls him up because this guy just won't leave. He's staying still within the borders of the county. And so she's got Morris to come deal with it. And they basically just have to go confront him and, like, deal with why he won't leave. And he's kind of, like, begging to stay because he's scared to leave the outside of the safety of the world. It's like I think it's about 14, 15 pages. That's what it's dealing with there. And I felt like both of them, both stories are kind of their standalone tales, but they introduce you to the world. And then we can work on like bigger story arcs afterwards. But both of them give you like, I've written them myself. They introduce you to the world. And then you get to see some Morris and some Beatrice. And then the third book is just, I'm collecting all the pinups. Yeah, I think.
That makes 30, sense. Yeah, yeah.
Over 30 pinups. I think it's going to be a 32-page book.
Cool.
And yeah, it's just like I asked for so many pinups, which is great. Amazing artists. And then so I just decided that I would make that an incentive, just like called the Morris Gallery.
Okay.
And it's just like all the pinups in one shot.
So is that the straight up, because I've recently been on Kickstarter seeing the Art Tiver Kickstarter that he's doing for his art book. But then do you have different tiers for different pledges, or is it just...
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I have... So, like, the rundown is you get, you know, digital copies are a cheaper thing. And then you can get Morris Issue 1. You get Morris Issue 1 plus 0. Then you can get all three books with the gallery.
Okay.
And then there's prints involved. There's, like, different tiers where you can get one print or three prints. You choose from... I think there's 37 different options of prints, so you can choose... one or three of those like 37 prints. And then there's original art pages.
Okay.
The more expensive tiers are the original art for the covers.
Okay.
And then we have some, we have variant covers as well. And then there's tiers where I do watercolor commissions for people. I'll have blank covers, like everyone's doing those, like the Marvel and DC, the blank sketch covers.
Right.
So there'll be options where you can just buy your own just blank cover and do your own sketch on it, or and then resale it or whatever you want to do. Or there's ones if you want to buy the sketch cover and I'll do a sketch on it for you. And cool. Then what else is there? I don't know. I think that's most of the tiers, commissions and stuff like that.
So what's the goal that you're going for specifically for this?
I decided on a goal of $7,500, which is not a ton, but it's not nothing.
Like right.
I'm a little bit worried that it's a bit too high.
Right.
But I think we can get it. I think we can hit it.
I think so too.
I mean, the majority of the money is going towards printing and then like shipping. And then there's some production, like the video production, the music production, paying for coloring. Mm-hmm. My Morris logo design was done by Chris Johnson. Pay him for like that type of stuff. So that's where it's kind of broken down, but it's mostly just going towards like the printing of the three main books.
Yeah. I don't know what it is specifically about this idea, but I could be completely wrong because I'm sure there's something out there like it, but I don't feel like there's anything out there in my mind that comes to me of this type of a story, of a Western taking place in the future with that old style Western that you're going for with the anthropomorphic or
anthropomorphic. Yeah,
that combination of, so it's kind of like a,
they're just lizards that wear pants, so they're anthropomorphic.
Yeah, but it's not, Western isn't a novel idea, but the combination of it is not something that I feel like people may want something like this.
I hope so. Thank you. I'm happy you said that, because I think that's part of why people are like, the thing is, when you do something, say like a Walking Dead that's so successful, then everyone does their own zombie book.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, we have our own little twist on it, but it's really not that original. So it's like, how do you, but I feel like people do that because people will buy it. If they like Walking Dead, they'll like this zombie book, and they'll like this other zombie book, which is fair. But me personally, I like things that I feel like haven't been done before.
Yeah.
And not that this hasn't been done before, because there's like Westworld.
There's
and
East Meast West. Yeah. Was that
the East book? Of West?
East is that of West. Called? And
then there's like Dark Tower, which is kind of, you know.
Yeah, it's there.
So I don't want to act like I'm super original. My main thing was I did the Morris and I wanted it to be a Western. But I also want it to be not so limited. I would like to have anthropomorphic animals show up. Zombies, if I want. I'd like to have, like, I drew a drawing of Morris with a jetpack. And I was like, well, it'd be cool if he had some technology, you know, kind of made. So if it's post-apocalyptic, there's stuff left over. So he shows up in a tank made of old car parts or that's something. Interesting. You know? So you'll see him, like, in the first issue, he's in his garage and he's tinkering on an old engine. And not everyone, like, there's not a lot of technology. There's not, like, robots running around. But kind of like Morris and a few other people kind of have educated themselves and go, like, I can use these to build this. And so there is a little bit of technology still left over. But mostly it just feels like a cowboy Western movie, right?
But that's cool that you can have that old school cowboy Western feel. And when you feel the need for it, you can insert that Tomorrowland.
Yeah, exactly.
Type of technology. So you can watch
something like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But maybe the ugly is a monster, you know, something like that. Like, you can, like, play with that type of Western theme, so...
Right.
Yeah.
Talk to me about Westerns, because I understand how much people love Western movies, and I listened to you and Jay Clark talk about Westerns, so I went and watched Tombstone.
Yeah.
For the first time. I loved it. It was a great movie.
It's the best, right?
It's really good. It's really good, and I couldn't believe the amount of people that are in the cast.
It's like, insane.
It's crazy. So what are your... This might be a hard question to answer. What are your top five favorite Western movies that come to your mind, if you have to say, watch these and you'll see how great Westerns are? Okay,
see, this is the problem is, though, because I'm doing Morris, I think a lot of people think I'm like a Western expert now, where I'm not.
Okay.
But the ones I've seen, I tend to really like. So I guess if I had to do top five, like Tombstone's number one to me. Like, I think it's kind of... Like, true Western purists would be like, you don't pick a modern Western, right? Like, you have to pick an older spaghetti Western or a John Wayne or something like that, right?
Well, for you, what are the ones that...
Yeah, I'd say Tombstone's, like... Tombstone's maybe my favorite movie of all time.
Okay.
It's definitely up there, but it's definitely my favorite, like, Western. It just, every scene, every line is so good. And then you have to go with, I think, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Like, it's just... I mean, it's clearly, it's supposed to be Mexico, but it's clearly just Italy. But it's so beautifully shot. The score, everything is so good. Yeah, it's just the quiet, the pacing. Like, you don't get that a lot anymore. That's what I really want. Like, just quiet scenes of scenery and stuff like that. I absolutely love, I mean, I love John Wayne, but the John Wayne True Grit is not... anything, like, it's not near the book or like the Coen Brothers remake in 2010 with Jeff Bridges as Rooster Colburn. It's so good. It's just like a perfect Western. So okay, let's see. Tombstone, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, True Grit. You know what I love, and I was telling you about it before, is Open Range. It's 2004, I think, and it's Kevin Costner and Robert Duvall. and they're kind of these free grazers that get mixed up in this little town of these people that hate people with big herds of cattle coming by and like free grazing on their land. And Kevin Costner is just such a badass. Like, he's wearing the, even his cowboy hat's kind of stupid, you know, it's kind of like frumpy, like I don't know, it's just dumb, but he's so good in it. Like, I'm such a big Kevin Costner fan. So
did you like Wyatt Earp?
I didn't like Wyatt Earp.
Okay.
Because it came out the same year, I think the same year as Tombstone.
When I was watching Tombstone, I mean, I went into it completely, you know.
No, because Wyatt Earp is, it's the classic Kevin Costner, which I love, but he every Kevin Costner movie is 3 hours long. And it's the entire story of Wyatt Earp. Whereas Tombstone is, you get into when he leaves Dodge and he gets to Tombstone. And then you just, basically it's the rundown of like the shootout of the OK Corral and then just the his battle with the Cowboys at the end, which is like the meaty stuff you want of Wyatt Earp, right? And it's your classic reluctant, like you don't get to see Wyatt Earp as a young man. You get the, I've been there, done that. I'm trying to retire and get away from this life.
He's already the legend.
And he gets dragged back into it, right?
Yeah.
Whereas like Kevin Costner's, and then I think they had like, I can't remember the guy who plays Doc Holliday in it. I think it's Dennis Quaid.
And nothing you're like, will be as good as,
no,
as
Val Kilmer 100% should have won an Oscar. He is so great as Doc Holliday.
I totally believe that he was going to die in that movie.
Yeah, like, he's so pale and sweaty. And like, you know what's even amazing? Like, you think you know, like you see all these amazing cameos and these actors, and there's like Powers Booth, and you see like Charlton Heston at the end. Yeah. The very first scene with Doc Holliday, you know who he, that guy he kills? Frank Stallone. Stallone's brother.
Really?
Yeah, that's the guy
that... It was just so much... There was so much... So many people in that movie, as I'm watching it, I'm just like, oh, he's in it too. Oh, he's in it too.
It's so good.
Yeah, but... And they all... Like, the performances were good.
Yes, and all the reviews I've read of it that kind of talk bad about it, the best thing they say is that, like, it's just a big show of, like, machismo, every scene, every guy trying to, like, out alpha male the other guy, and I'm like...
It's the Wild West.
It's the Wild West, and, I mean, as a male, I love that type of stuff, right? Like, I can understand why a woman might not want to watch Tombstone. Same reason a woman might not want to watch Snatch by Guy Ritchie, right? Like, there's not a lot of women in it, it's mostly guys kind of, like, trying to be super macho, but like as far as I go, I love it to death. I think it's so beautiful.
My father-in-law has a huge movie collection. Like it's an entire clothing closet from the top to bottom, just movies.
Yeah.
So I go when I go to his house, I go into Blockbuster, and when I found Tombstone in the piles, I pulled it out and I said it was actually my wife who's like, that's a great movie.
Oh,
you have to bring that home. So she never has a problem. Like when I ask her stuff, like, hey, that bother you that it's like so. Yeah. She doesn't care about. Like I watched Wonder Woman with her, and I'm like, so how did you feel watching it? Yeah. She's like, I don't care. I want Batman.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, like, we lump all women together and go like,
yeah,
women want girly stuff, but not every woman does.
No, she loved it. Yeah, she was like, fair. This is great.
Yeah.
So she was the one who actually reinforced your opinion of the movie being like, this is an awesome movie.
I love it to death.
Yeah, it was a good movie.
Yeah, I actually, a girl, I used to work at Shopper Drug Mart, and a girl I worked with, she loved Tombstone too. And so we always talked about it. And we got everyone at work kind of talking, and we had a big viewing party at someone's house, and we all watched Tombstone. And this one guy who was kind of, you know, he looks up to everybody, and he like really loved me. And after we like talked about Tombstone and we watched it, he just started wearing a cowboy hat all the time. I'm not even joking. Like, it was like crazy. We're like, yeah, he just wears a cowboy hat now after he watched Tombstone. And then we had a party here, like out on the rooftop. And I went to the dollar store in the summer and I bought like all the cowboy hats they had. So he showed up with his cowboy hat and we just buzzed at everyone. It was just like a big cowboy hat party to make fun of him, but he loved it so much. Like,
that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great.
What other? Oh, you know what? You got to talk about. I think I just said three movies, but Unforgiven. Have you seen Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood?
I did, but I went into it not appreciating how great of a movie it was because it won an Oscar and everything,
it's
right?
So good. And like,
I have to revisit
the thing is, you have to let it build because the first 45 minutes, it's just build. So I get why, like, I love it, but I can understand why people don't think it's that great. But you get to that end scene, like after they, I guess, spoiler alert, after they kill Morgan Freeman's character and he just... the second he finds out, he just, because he doesn't drink anymore, right? He's like this shitty farmer who's like an old killer that doesn't want to do that anymore. And then when he finds out they killed Morgan Freeman, you just see him grab that whiskey and he just starts chugging. And then he just turns into like the baddest motherfucker on earth. It's, and like that, and like it's worth it all. Just that whole build for when Gene Hackman's just like, "You just killed an unarmed man," and he's like, "Should have armed himself. He's gonna decorate his bar with my friend." And then he just kills everyone. It's just the greatest.
That's hilarious.
Spoiler alert, by the way.
Yeah. In case anyone's never watched Unforgiven yet. So. That's four. That's four. What's your fifth?
I don't know. Probably another one like Fistful of Dollars or For a Few Dollars More.
I have to.
You know what? Back to the Future 3.
There you go.
That's my. No one gives it the love it needs. It's such.
That was the only Western that I knew back to front. Like I knew that movie as a Western, but I see that.
Everyone talks about it like it's this pariah of this franchise, but it's so good. Why do people not like Back to the Future 3? It's a Western.
I'm not exactly
sure. It's the same exact formula as all the other ones.
I mean, it's good characters. It's a good story. You know clearly what it is that they have to do.
Yeah.
And I think they capture all of the... I don't know. I'm not a Western expert. But when I watch it, I'm like, this is what Westerns are like. Other than the time travel aspect. Yeah. Like, this is fun.
That made me realize that, like, I remember watching True Grit with a friend, and my buddy was just like, this is, like, what a life this would be. Like, just living on the range and, you know, like, being a cowboy. And I was like, I would get murdered so fast. If we got in a time machine, I went back in time, I'd insult someone by accident and just get murdered immediately.
You like, accidentally spit in the wrong bucket.
Yeah, I'd just be like, I'd call them a liar, and then they'd just shoot me in the face.
It was crazy. It was just nuts. Like, let's take it outside. Yeah, so and when they took it outside, it wasn't like the fisticuffs. Yeah. It was like, who's quicker on the draw?
I remember when Marty McFly, and they're like, what's your name? And he's like, Clint Eastwood. And they're like, what kind of pansy name is that, boy? And you're like, oh, that's the coolest name you could say. What are you talking about? Like, he's a cowboy.
You're on that, like, pink fool.
Yeah, what kind of stupid name is that? Yeah, I love that movie.
And he moonwalks on him?
Yeah, he moonwalks. Oh, and he's great. Yeah, he's shooting the gun to dance. They're just fucking... I remember that. That's the first time I really noticed, like, chewing tobacco and, like, the spittoons. And I was like, oh, Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what?
All the toys out.
I mean, there's so many good Westerns, but I'm going to go with Back to the Future 3 because it gets no love. I
appreciate it. It gets no love. I appreciate that. I love that movie. So, we were talking before when we were having some dinner, and you said you're done with super, like, the big two, right?
I'm not sure I should maybe walk you with that big world.
That's okay. You're done with the big two for the most part.
I mean, I don't buy them.
You don't buy them. But you also said that you are not into superhero movies. Haven't watched any.
Yeah, I have watched some. I don't like them.
Which ones did you watch?
I mean, I've seen bits and pieces of both Avengers, Thor movies, Iron Man's, Captain America's. I think it's cool to see these characters, you know, with all the special effects and stuff. But I feel like, especially the Marvel movies, it literally feels like the same movie. It's the same plot points. Like, when you watch any of the Thor... How many is there? Three Thor movies?
It's going to be a third.
Yeah. There's three Iron Mans.
Yeah.
Two Captain Americas, three Captain Americas.
Three Captain Americas.
And two Avengers. I watched the Avengers, or, like, I watched the first Avengers, and then I remember I was at a friend's house, and the second one was on. And I was like, this is the same movie. They're all the same fucking movie. Like,
the Captain Americas, I feel, are the ones, for me, that kind of set the bar high for... The Winter Soldier made me like the first movie more.
Okay.
And then the third movie was more like an Avengers movie because everybody's in it. The Civil War. But I felt that...
I thought it was an Avengers movie. I didn't realize that was...
Captain America. But Winter Soldier was really, really good when you see the character development and the relationships that he has. But the reason why I bring it up, and I know you've been told this before, but being a Western guy, I think you'd like Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, everyone tells me I'd like Guardians of the Galaxy. The thing is, I don't really like things that much, and I don't like watching a lot of new movies. Like, I remember, Logan, when I saw that, I was like, that seems really cool, right? Yeah, and I remember seeing the trailer, and I was. I want to see that. And that came out in March. I still haven't seen it yet.
I think I would, but
I don't really watch movies I want to see. When people recommend me movies that I don't care about, I'm like probably not going to watch it.
I just, every time I saw Michael Rooker in Tombstone,
yeah,
I'm like,
oh yeah,
he's got to watch Guardians.
Before Walking Dead, he forever to me is just Hal from Cliffhanger.
Yeah,
like that's yeah, how I that always too. Knew him.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like the dad in Mallrats too, but like everyone knows him as Michael Rooker now from Guardians and Walking Dead, but he's Hal from Cliffhanger.
It was weird because I'm watching, I've seen the Guardians of the Galaxy movies a number of times, and then I had just finished, I bought Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, and I'm watching, he plays a big role in that as Yondu, yeah. And then immediately after, the next movie I watched was Tombstone.
Yeah.
And I'm like, hey.
And Kurt Russell's in Guardians of the Galaxy, too.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, I'm like, yeah. Well, they're right there. Yeah. Like, there's Yondu, right? And then, out of complete coincidence, the next movie that I borrowed from my father-in-law, that me and my wife watched, was Cliffhanger.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, this guy's in every movie.
I love Cliffhanger. It's yeah. So good.
Yeah. So the more I was watching, I'm like, I gotta tell Shane that he's gotta just watch Guardians of the Galaxy because I think you'll like
just
it.
Just for the Rooker.
Just for the Rooker. Yeah, and it is kind of like a Western in space. Yeah. It breaks the mold of the other Marvel movies. It has that humor. It has the off the wall characters, but then there's that Ravager.
I'm not gonna watch it. Yeah, I'm not gonna watch it. I mean, I'll watch it if someone's watching it and I'm in the same room.
Yeah,
but I'll never.
You'll never go out of your way to watch it.
Watch this.
Yeah, that's so funny.
Yeah, I don't like it.
Just so comic book movies are just. It's so weird because all of us are so like, are you gonna go watch it? And we buy our tickets
Don't care. People get so excited with Spider-Man. I'm like, I don't know. Are they gonna show how he gets bit by a spider again?
And they didn't.
Yeah, I guess
whatever. They didn't, which was kind of cool.
I think I appreciate art. Like, I'd rather read a comic book.
Me too.
Like, I don't... Like, yeah, maybe Scott Pilgrim's a good movie, but I'd rather read the books because I like that hard line art.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just don't get that excited about... I like movies that are meant to be movies. Like, I'd rather watch a Coen Brothers movie or something. You know, and, like, I don't really
want to
watch...
Okay, yeah. Adaptation.
Yeah, I don't want to just happen to see Captain America. It looks like you're watching a video game, you know? Mm. Special effects are cool. But I don't relate to it. I don't know. I just don't want to see it. I'd rather watch a Wes Anderson movie, you know, something that's not a cookie cutter thing.
Okay.
Oh, you know what? On my Western list, I should have put, it's not cowboys, but have you ever seen No Country for Old Men?
No.
It's actually better than Tombstone. It's maybe my favorite movie of all
time. Really?
It's,
okay.
And people constantly talk about it. Like, it's set in the 80s, but it's basically like a Western. And you just get these like three characters where you get the one guy who has this like he stumbles upon this drug case from this drug deal gone bad. Mm-hmm. Then the bad guy they hired to hunt him down, and then the sheriff hunting him down. So you get all three of these characters who I'm not sure they ever actually come face to face, and it's the most tense movie of all time. And it's basically like a Western, but it's set in the 80s in like Texas. But if you ever watch No Country for Old Men, that's the next movie you have to watch. It's
okay.
It's so beautiful. Okay. That's a movie.
That's with Javier Bardem, right?
Javier Bardem is maybe my favorite villain of all time. Like, I think even better than Darth Vader.
Really?
Yeah, he plays Anton Chigurh, and he's amazing. He
knocks it out.
He's just like the Grim Reaper, but like, he's so good.
Okay, No Country for Old Men. It's on the list.
You gotta watch it.
On the list. All right. So... Before we wrap up, I'm gonna ask you a couple of random questions. You can wrap
lightning fire. Round.
Lightning round.
All right. Okay. So these are this or that, or
I'm gonna try to do a this or that with you.
I like that when you were doing it with Daph. That was my favorite episode.
Yeah, I'm gonna try to do that with you. So, were you Marvel or DC?
Both. But if I had to choose one, I think Marvel. But I love both of them very much. But I think if I had to choose, I guess I'm more of a Marvel guy.
Were you Justice League or Avengers?
Justice League, more.
X-Men or Teen Titans?
X-Men.
Okay. You already said George Perez, if you have to pick one.
Between him and John Byrne?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really tough one. I love them both. But yeah, Perez is my go-to guy.
What was your favorite comic book series? If you had to pick one series that was your...
Like of all time?
Yeah. If someone said to you, hey, what would you recommend me to read as like just not a comic book... I'm new to comic book. What would you recommend me to read? What's your favorite?
It's so hard. So I have like your say top five, top ten. I always thought Preacher was my all time favorite. Like if you would ask me, I would have been like, the entire series of Preacher by Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon is just the best comic book of all time. But recently, like neck and neck, and I think I like it better. And I've just might just be recency because I read it again. But Planetary by Warren Ellis and John Cassidy is just like, it's so perfect. It's such a beautiful, perfect book. Everything about it, there's nothing is wasted. Everything adds up to something in the end. And it's just the greatest. I don't know, you ever read Planetary?
I haven't read Planetary.
You gotta read Planetary.
Okay.
It's like, it's the greatest.
Okay.
They're basically,
team.
They're superhero archaeologists.
Okay.
And so the first 12 issues, or like, it's in trades now, the first like two trades, they're just, you're seeing all these cool different like discoveries of them, like discovering Superman like characters or whatever, right? And then after that, you start to find out like what's really happening, and it just all adds up. And it's just, it's so good. It's just a perfect book.
So Planetary is the book.
I think Planetary has beat out Preacher for me. Preacher for the longest time, but now I have to say Planetary.
Time does that.
I love Preacher so much. But just Planetary is just so perfect. Like everything about it is perfect. It not a panel spot. Is wasted.
Cool. And John Cassidy.
I love Cassidy.
Yeah. Okay. What was, if you can remember, is another hard one. Best superhero cartoon you were watching growing up, which is the one for you that was your go-to?
Superhero cartoon? I think it's got to be the X-Men. I was a child of the 90s, and like that's when I was really obsessed with X-Men, was that cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's got to be the X-Men cartoon, right?
Did you have a favorite X-Men character?
Yeah, I mean, I think Wolverine is my favorite, but I didn't want to... Everyone loved Wolverine, so I didn't want to be like a... I love Wolverine.
Yeah.
A bunch of us that loved Wolverine kind of just inherited Gambit instead, because he was still kind of like an outsider of the team, you know? He was like, and he's cool. Gambit's cool.
Right.
Yeah, we drew a lot of him throwing playing cards growing up.
Yeah, I think, was it Jim Lee that created Gambit? Was he the guy who got the credit for Gambit? I think he said at the last expo,
someone
had asked him how he came up with that character.
Maybe he might have been on. I think Gambit's first appearance is maybe an Uncanny.
Yeah,
and it might have been. Is she humping? What's she doing?
Yeah, she's.
That's the first she's ever done that.
She's enjoying that pillow.
She's not even a boy.
Yeah, they do that.
I've never seen her do that before.
Yeah, they do that.
She just humped a pillow. That was odd.
This is numerous exclusives on this.
Yeah, yes. It's just so weird. What was she doing?
She's getting out some pent-up energy. All right. Favorite music growing up? Favorite music genre? Do you have one? Or you?
I have no favorite genre. Okay. I just love music. I love country music. I love hip-hop. I love classic rock. I love everything.
What's your go-to country album or artist? Is there like a...
Yeah. Go-to? I really like Shooter Jennings. He's Waylon Jennings' son. And he has this album called Put the O Back in Country. Because he thought like new country music's too kind of like, I don't know, lame and pop. So
right.
Like,
yeah,
he
sure.
went back to his roots or whatever. But no, you know what it is? I bought this album. It's George Jones and Merle Haggard singing each other's hits. And just the old like classic voice guys. And I think it's called Kicking Out the Footlights or something like that. Yeah, George Jones singing Merle Haggard and Merle Haggard singing George Jones. That's my favorite.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you said classic rock. What's your favorite classic rock?
For a long time, I thought Zeppelin was just the greatest thing ever.
Yeah, everybody does.
And I love, but the older I get, I'm like, I love the Beatles too. But mm-hmm. as far as like rock guys go, like it's the Stones. I read this book called "Exile on Main Street: A Summer in Hell with the Rolling Stones," and it's just about how like Mick Jagger fucked Keith Richards' girl. And then Keith Richards has this passive-aggressive way of getting back at him by, like, staying inside with the girl doing heroin.
Oh, my goodness.
Not coming down to write music with them. And then they leave, and he'd call them up at 2 a.m. and be like, I wrote this song, get over here. And it's like, you always think of these rock stars, you know, especially, like, famous duo kind of rock stars, lead guitarist and singer. You think of them as, like, best buddies. And I always kind of just in my head was like, yeah, Keith Richards and Mick Jagger are, like, best friends. And they kind of hate each other. And their passive-aggressive way of getting back at each other is making, like, genius music.
And I think Exile on Main Street might be like the best rock and roll album of all time.
That's it. When you put it in that perspective, like they dislike each other so much that it comes out.
Yeah.
That's.
Yeah, like they rented this villa in the French Riviera in Keith Richards' place, and Keith Richards would stay in the room with the girl that Mick Jagger wanted to be with, that Mick Jagger had sex with, and he would just do heroin with her, and they'd all wait for Keith because they need him to write the music. So then they'd eventually lose interest and go like, fuck this guy, and they'd leave. And then at 2 a.m. he'd call them and be like, I just wrote like the lick for like Rocks Off or like whatever. And then they'd all come over and have to write. Like, it was like this weird passive aggressive thing.
So strange.
And they made a double album of just like some of the best music of all time.
Drugs can do strange things to you.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
Even the Beatles, right? Their best albums were when what were they on, LSD at the time?
Yeah, I think they did a lot of stuff. It's like, I think Sgt. Pepper and Revolver and Rubber Soul are a lot of LSD.
Yeah. And it was a white album too that followed Sgt. Pepper's. Yeah.
Well, I think someone said this too. They were like, the it's not a choice about like who's better, the Rolling Stones or the Beatles. It's more about how you identify yourself.
Yeah.
And I always thought like Beatles on paper wrote better music and they're like more I don't know, they were like geniuses and they tried new things. Stones did that too, but Stones were just kind of like, if the Beatles were like sexier and like more rock stars, you know what I mean? Like they were kind of just a disaster.
Embraced, that lifestyle. Got you. Yeah. That makes sense. Okay, hip hop. What was the favorite hip hop album for you?
Yeah, what's your favorite hip hop album? Illmatic? It's got to be Illmatic. You're going to say Illmatic.
It's the one... You know what it is? I say Illmatic because people are like, oh, I thought it was this one. I thought it was that one. It's more because it's that standard bearer.
Yeah.
So even if I like something better than that, I can recognize that this is... It deserves a spot at number one. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So before I would always kind of like pick my favorite and justify why I thought it was the best.
Yeah.
As opposed to saying, even though this is my favorite, something can be the champ. It can have the title. So Illmatic is that vinyl that I feel like if you own a great music collection, if you have one hip hop album in that collection, it should be Illmatic.
Yeah, that's fair to say.
That's how I look at it.
It's also like, it's just gotta be those ones where you can put it on and you don't want to skip a song. Like, they're all just so good.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, Illmatic falls into that. But I got into Nas later, so it wasn't, like, my jam.
I got into that later, too.
But it's gotta be, like, I'm constantly torn between, like, I grew up, like, we were big on, like, West Coast Death Row. That was our jam. And I think Doggy Style is just one of the best albums of all time. But also, I love... I think the most perfect hip hop album has to be 36 Chambers.
That's up there too.
Like, I love Wu-Tang so much. So yeah, it's like Doggy Style or 36 Chambers. I don't know how to choose
between. What's crazy about that is that you had Doggy Style, Midnight Marauders, and 36 Chambers came out. Those two albums came out on the same day.
In 93, right?
93. Yeah. And not far after that, Illmatic came out in 94 and Ready to Die. And Only Built for Cuban Links.
And East 99 came out too, the Bone Thugs album.
Yeah, that came out. And then Me Against the World. Like, it's just within that small time span, it was just
93, like, 94 era of hip hop is insane.
Even to 96.
Who's your favorite Wu-Tang member?
Ghostface.
Yeah.
Ghostface was my favorite Wu-Tang member.
Why?
I
love him too. I'm just curious why.
He was the one who I caught on to the later. It was, to me, it was always like, Method Man's the man.
Yeah,
like,
Method Man was the first breakout.
He's the star.
Yeah.
But when I started to really, really listen and collect music a little more, he was the most diverse, the most consistent.
Yeah.
And he had the most, I guess diversity for me is a big deal.
Yeah.
And he made great albums, solo albums.
Yeah.
Whereas the other guys were very dependent on the collaborations. Like, I think Method Man is one of the greatest collaborators in hip hop. Like, he's like a Busta Rhymes.
Sure.
But
Ghostface, all of his albums are like filled with like Raekwon and Capo.
They are. But like, Raekwon's best album is heavily featured with Ghostface.
Yeah, it's a duo.
It's basically almost like a duo album. Yeah. Whereas I think Ghostface's best album is mostly just him, which is Supreme Clientele.
Yeah, I love it. But I also like, my favorite Wu-Tang guy is Capadonna.
Really?
He gets no credit because
he's not an original member, right?
The thing is, he is. But right. he was in jail when they did 36 Chambers. So he doesn't. Like, he should have been on the album, but he was in jail. So everyone kind of treats him like this pariah of the Wu-Tang because he's not the original member. But he was there at the beginning. And then, like, I love that in the late 90s or, like, early 2000s, he went crazy because of this. And he just quit rapping and drove a cab in
for a while.
But I love, like, when you hear Kappa on, like, Winter Wars or, like, Iron Maiden. And like, he's so good, man.
Yeah, they were. You know who else I really, really liked? Like, if someone were to say, so, Supreme Clientele, I bought that off of the strength of, it got 4.5 mics in the source.
Yeah,
I knew nothing about Ghostface other than he was a Wu-Tang member.
Yeah,
and so I didn't understand anything he was saying when I was in like yeah. grade 10 or 11. I was just like, this guy's just rapping his butt off.
Sometimes you still don't know what the fuck he's talking about.
Yeah. And when I went back and listened to it, I'm like, wow, this is as good as they said it was.
Yeah.
But looking back from solo projects,
yeah.
might have been Liquid Swords.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, that was...
But I think, yeah, Ghost had the best solo albums because he had multiple, like
yeah.
Fish Scale, Bulletproof Wallets. Like, there's so many good ones.
Yeah.
Pretty Tony album's great, too.
So. Yeah, I think he was the most well-rounded, consistent member of them all.
I always think, like, because people get excited about a new Wu-Tang album, and I think, like...
It's done.
When the 8 Diagrams came out, it really hit home that these guys were a super group, and they don't work together anymore. Like, RZA's not on the same page as Ghost, and he's not on the same page as GZA. Like, they're just all over the place, these guys. Yeah. And I don't think it's... Like, I think when they were young, they were all hungry, so it worked together, but they're... That's done now. Like, they're two different.
And their first couple of solo albums were very heavily featured as, like, extensions of the group.
Yeah, and RZA produced, like, almost all of that stuff.
Exactly.
Right?
So, yeah. Exactly. So you felt like it was just a branch off of the tree of what you already knew.
Absolutely, yeah.
Whereas I feel like Supreme Clientele really was, this guy is all, he's doing this off of the strength of him.
Yeah, I think so. That was the first Wu-Tang solo album that I thought, I agree
with. It was on a higher tier, but it was because of his
Yeah, that's, I went back and listened to Supreme Clientele in its entirety a couple years ago, and it's so good.
It's bananas. It's bananas.
Yeah, that song One, like, it's so good.
Yeah.
How many nuts you gonna bust? One. How many cakes we gonna bake? One.
Yeah,
that Stroke of Death. Yeah, it's so good. That album's amazing.
It's a great album. So you picked Doggy Style. Oh, yeah.
I don't know how to pick between Doggy Style and 36 Chambers. No, I have... The nostalgia of me as a kid listening to Doggy Style. But as far as, like, if I had to go, like, how do you grade these albums? Like, 36 Chambers is it's so more complete, I think.
You know what? Like,
the kid in me says Doggy Style, the adult says 36
Chambers. And that's where I change my opinion too, because the kid in me picks different stuff, but now I listen to it, I'm like, I kind of cringe when I listen to certain things that I really liked back then as like a 17-year-old. Like, I can't listen to Big Pimpin' now and feel comfortable about it. Yeah, like, I'm just like, I'm not this... I don't
act like it's good, but I still like it.
No. I think, like, as far as the technique is concerned, of all of those three guys on that track, it's a very, like, well-made song, but it's more the content. I'm just like, meh.
Well, it's like Jay-Z just became, like, a pop star, basically, right? Like,
well, it is, but it isn't, because it's a very different-sounding song. Like,
what's your guilty pleasure? Like, something like I always say, I love Juicy J. And like 36 Mafia. And the lyrics are terrible. But I love, like, me and my friends, we get so excited. We put on a Juicy J track. It's like, what's something that you, like, you know it sucks, but you like it anyways. You know what I mean?
Wow.
You know what? Or like something that if you had on your iPod, you'd be embarrassed if someone, like, scrolled by it. And not just hip hop, like anything. Like, if you have any Justin Bieber or something, you'd be like, oh, no, that's on there for another reason.
You know, I got my guilty pleasure on my iPod. I got some 90s pop, Backstreet Boys, Spice Girls. Yeah. And then probably my guilty pleasure that I have, I'm not even guilty about, I more than happily admit that I like it, is Rick Astley.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
I loved that era when people were getting Rickrolled.
Yeah, yeah. I was
probably the only person who was happy to get Rickrolled.
I love that album. I listened to that
video.
Yeah.
I can talk about that video all day long. He's like,
because I remember coat.
I remember my mom told me that all the women heard him on the radio and they were like, this guy's got the sexiest voice.
And then
they saw that video and they were like, what the fuck is this? He's a skinny little ginger guy. And like, there's that scene where he's wearing like a Canadian tuxedo and like the denim shirt's just buttoned right up.
Right.
And he's like dancing in front of like a fence, a chain link fence. And then they're like, he's in an empty banquet hall with the two girls and he's singing for like the bartender guy who's cleaning glasses. But then the bartender guy's kind of like, yeah, this is cool. I like this. And then they cut to the alley, and they're all dancing in the alley. And the bartender guy's got, like, the shortest shorts on, and he's, like, doing backflips up the wall.
It's crazy.
It's wild.
It's crazy.
I look at that video. I just love it so much.
yeah, probably that's my guilty. But hip-hop-wise, oh, man.
Yeah, like, do you have, like, a 3-6 where you go, like, this isn't good, but I love it? Like, Three Six Mafia, one of my favorite songs is called Weed Blow Pills. And he's like, the intro of the song, he goes like, yeah, there's a song about our favorite influences. It's called Weed Blow Pills. And he's just like, I think the hook is like, weed, blow, pills.
maybe it might have been like the Diplomats.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Something like that. I thought they were so good at the time. I love their sound. But looking back, I'm like, this is so like lazy.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair.
So maybe something like that was a guilty pleasure. 50 Cent, maybe. He was huge at the time, and everybody was like, this is the greatest thing ever. And the production...
Doesn't hold up for you?
I
never really liked 50 Cent, so...
To me, like, I thought he was just a more... what's the word? Not dangerous, but like a more hardcore version of Ja Rule. Everything made Ja Rule successful, 50 Cent the exact same thing.
Yeah, that's fair.
He just made it more like, I'm a gangster.
Yeah, that's
you believed it. You believed his street cred a little bit more.
Yeah, but he was shot 9 times.
He was exactly like Ja Rule.
Yeah, I'm with that. Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah, I really love too. Is like, and a lot of his shit is Game though. Game's
he had talent, but you know what I didn't like about him? He depended so much on name dropping stuff.
That's his whole like.
It was irritating.
It's a weird thing where I feel like Ice Cube did it too, and then he was like, "Oh, that's Ice Cube's thing. I'm going to do it too." And then he like, instead of trying to get away from it, he embraced it and it's like, this is my style. This is what I do.
Yeah, it became too and much you're right. of a shtick.
He's a really good rapper, but he can't stop name dropping. It's the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say that. I agree with you.
Yeah, that's the... I liked his first style. I know his other stuff was always well received, but I never... It's kind of like with wrestling. There was a time with wrestling and hip hop where I was kind of like... I don't know if I'm liking the new stuff that's coming anymore.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. It kind of was all in the same era. Yeah. Once the South kind of became the new standard of hip hop, I was just like, eh.
Even that was fun though. Like it's better than the mumble rap.
It was. It's better than the mumble rap, but it was just kind of like the bar has dropped a little bit of what we expect these guys to be able to do. Like,
yeah, that's fair.
When you look at the guys who were considered the like top tier talent back in the day,
yeah,
they had to be very different from each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's fair.
You know, and then it and I guess in the Dirty South hip hop,
well, there's like Scarface and there's like Outkast.
They were great.
And then like I can't think of many more that were really.
I thought
like T.I. was really T.I.
was good, and I thought actually Ludacris was a good talent.
Yeah, Ludacris was fun when I was 16.
You know what I mean?
And he gets old pretty quick.
But I was never like, I never got on the Lil Wayne train. I never bought into
it. I liked Cash Money, although that, like, I knew it was garbage, but I liked it because it was fun.
Yeah.
Did you ever watch the, I think it's the Justin Bieber roast, and Ludacris is there, and one of the comedians, I think it's Pete Davidson from Saturday Night Live, he goes, "You might recognize Ludacris from your mom's That's What I Call Hip Hop CD." I always think of that now when I see Ludacris.
I can't believe
he's got like the short hair and everything.
It's like 20 years ago.
Yeah, but remember when like what was that? What's the name of that song? The Cadillac Grills. Check out the what's that song called? Fuck, I can't remember it now. Check out the oil my Cadillac spills.
I just remember Throw Them Bows.
Yeah. That's all I remember. I can't remember the name of that song. Fuck. That was like the biggest thing. And then when Roll Out came out, we were like, "What? Who is this guy?" Like, yeah. He came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And then he got really old really quick. He overstayed his welcome very
and
fast.
And that's, I think, the hallmark of what makes certain guys legends.
Yeah.
And guys superstars.
Yeah, that's
is,
fair.
Is after your fifth album... What happened? Is your sixth album
yeah
your best? Or are you kind of like, no one's listening anymore? Whereas you look at guys like Nas.
Yeah.
His last album, even though it's a couple years ago, is a lot worth talking about.
Yeah, or like the Untitled one that he wanted to name like the N-word or whatever.
Exactly, exactly.
That's such a good album.
Exactly.
But he also suffers like, Illmatic was so well received, like it's hard to live up to
it's
that.
It's hard
right?
to
like,
live up to
freshman
it.
Curse.
But he's had a couple of albums that are, you know, his fifth album was still Illmatic.
Yeah, that's right. But also, like, I love Snoop, but Snoop's never had another good album.
Exactly.
He's great on other people's songs.
Exactly.
But I don't think I like any other Snoop album other than Doggy Style.
He's never hit that peak again.
No, but he shows up on, like, a Corrupt track, and you're like, he's amazing.
Yeah. He's had good albums, but never enough, like, to keep him in that
He's never had another album that I would listen straight through without skipping it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, that's where I say to people, never mind the mixtapes, never mind that one big album. Where are they? Where were they at album 5 or album 6?
Yeah, that's fair.
Because that's like, it's kind of like, to me, I always compare mixtapes to an artist doing a sketch.
Yeah.
And then you got a guy who does a full book.
Yeah, that's true. That's
and you
fair.
Can, and you can see what they're really made of.
Yeah, that's fair.
Right? So we got to.
We talked for a long time.
Yeah, this is almost 2 hours.
Holy shit.
Did it feel like it?
No, I don't know.
I felt it went pretty quick.
It was very comfortable.
Oh, that's good.
We also talked for like 2 hours before.
I know, at the pub. We got to wrap it up. Well, thank you for doing this. This is awesome. We got to have you back. We get more into hip hop talk if you want
to. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Awesome. So, guys, stay tuned for more Kickstarter news.
Yeah.
Where can they follow you?
Just check out my Facebook page, Shane Herron Art. Shane Herron is spelled like Shane. Heron, like the bird, heron. And then, or check out Black Hole Hunters Club on Facebook. Well, and then, I don't know, my Instagram, at Shane Herron, I think that is.
And you'll keep everyone posted with what's happening.
If you go like those pages, you'll get everything you need. Yeah. When Morris comes, I'll be annoying everyone with my updates and posts.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Thanks, dude. This has been a blast. Thank you, Riley, for being a part of the show.
She's tuckered now.
Yeah, she's tired.
It's a pillow.
It's a sign for all of us that when the dog gets tired, it's time for bed.
That's right.
All right. Thank you guys for listening. Remember to check us out at caveofsolitude.com and send your emails to caveofsolitude@outlook.com as well. Thank you guys for listening.
At Outlook?
caveofsolitude@outlook.
Outlook?
Yeah.
Do people still use Outlook?
Yes. Maybe I should change it.
At Hotmail.
I have a Hotmail email. That's what gets used. @outlook.com. You're confusing everybody. Thank you for listening, everyone. Talk to you
at AOL.